Johann, not much older than Vaughn, gave him a nod. He stood watching everybody, his eyes sharp, but said nothing.
"You'll need a shield, too."
Tulroof went back into the storeroom. Ketil said,
"You won't find much good steel in that barrel, boy."
He bumped into Vaughn, as if by accident.
"Oh, this suits me,"
Vaughn said. He held his ground, and Ketil had to step back. Big Johann was staring at the sword in Vaughn's hand. He pointed at the blade, where below the hilt now Vaughn saw old runes in the iron.
"Gut,"
Johann said. He nodded vigorously at Vaughn.
"Gut."
"What is the work here?"
Vaughn asked. Johann looked over at Ketil to answer. Obviously he had little Norse. Ketil said,
"It's easy enough. We keep the narrows. All that come by must give us some of what they carry."
Ketil stuck his chin out, pointing east.
"The big market lies beyond, where the river flows in. Through here is the quickest way there."
Vaughn knew this. He and his brothers had been on their way to this market. He had the sword in his hand. He could kill someone now. Tulroof brought him a leather sheath. Around him, three of the men who had killed his brothers. Then they stiffened, and all three were looking across the yard toward the hall. Vaughn followed their eyes. King Galdor had come out of the hall. He stood upon the threshold, his head thrown back. He wore a black bearskin cloak, a breastplate studded with metal. His sword swung at his hip. He stared at them a moment, saying nothing, and walked off across the yard. As he walked, his hand fell lightly to his sword. Tulroof muttered under his breath and made a sign with his fingers. Ketil said,
"Shut up, fool." "He's after me," Tulroof said. "He's after me all the time."
"That's a fine sword,"
Vaughn said.
"Galdor's sword." "No other has such a sword," Ketil said. "With that in his hand, he does not lose."
In Vaughn's mind, the weapon in his hand shrank to a twig. A few other men walked out of the hall, yawned, stretched. Ketil and Johann started toward them, calling out. Vaughn slid his new sword down into the scabbard. He could not kill them all. Galdor he should hate, not these. The girl from the kitchen was wandering by, a basket on her hip, her eyes not quite finding his. He followed Tulroof off to join the other men. At Undenmeal, he sat between Ketil and Tulroof, halfway up the table. While they were all eating, Galdor called out,
"We should have some poetry! Tulroof, give us a scolding!"
All around the hall, the men laughed and turned to stare at Tulroof, who had turned white as lambskin. He got to his feet. The jug was there, and he took a big slurp of the ale. The laughing swelled, expecting some amusement. Galdor was lounging in his place, smiling.
"Give us a poem, Tulroof! Speak!"
Tulroof's chest heaved. He said,
"On the Swan's Road,"
and gulped. Around the room, the jeering rose. Vaughn sat still, seeing this was an old practice. Tulroof's eyes bulged.
"The Raven Lord came, battled sweat, and—"
The yells of the other men rose to a roar, and from all sides they threw bread and bones and cheese at Tulroof, who flung his arms up to ward off the volleys and sank down on the bench. He covered his head with his arms. The table in front of Vaughn was littered with bits of food. "Up there," Galdor said.
"Well, that was disappointing."
The room hushed. Everybody waited, breathless, on the king, who looked around them all and finally said,
"Vaughn Akerson, perhaps you can do better."
Vaughn stood up. He swiped the crumbs off his sleeves. He said, "Odin's match is the Verboy's king." A disappointed cheer rose. Beside Varn, Ketil gave a cackle of a laugh.
"Figured it out, did you?"
On the high seat, Galdor raised his head and beamed. Varn said,
"Save he has both his eyes. His spears are bred, and his ravens are crows."
The general mutter of approval broke off. Ketil snorted. Galdor's smile froze. Varn was cobbling up another line, trying to work in a comparison of Valhalla and the Verboy. On either side, Ketil and Torulf yanked Varn down onto the bench. Around them, the table rumbled up a hard, smothered laughter. Galdor tilted forward from the high seat, staring down at Varn across the room, and his hands went to the sword lying on the table before him. The laughter stopped.
"Mighty king!"
On the far side of the room, another man leapt to his feet.
"Ringbreaker! Feeder of the eagles!"
Every head in the room swung toward this one, and he went on so for many lofty words. Varn sat still. He thought maybe he had shown himself too soon. But he was glad. Already Galdor was making a big point of sending this new poet a golden cup of mead. Next to Varn, Torulf clapped him on the shoulder and leaned toward his ear.
"Keep watch," he whispered. "Galdor won't forget."
He straightened. Up there, Galdor had turned to glare at Varn again. Ketil handed him the ale horn.
"You need this, fool."
Varn drank deep. Later, he saw Galdor still on his high seat, leaning on the arm to talk with a balding man, squat as a toad. After that one had gone away, Galdor sent a slave to fetch Varn up. When Varn stood before him, Galdor frowned at him.
"You are no scald. You annoyed me. So I want you to go up on the parapet and keep night watch. It's cold up there, in the wind, and it's likely to rain. You can think about where your stupid tongue has gotten you."
He sat back. The sword lay on the table between them. Varn said,
"Yes, King Galdor,"
and went off. There was some weather coming in as the night fell. He could feel it in the air. He stood on the parapet, looking into the dark, listening to the wind boom and sigh over the walls around him. The rain began, light as a veil. He thought a while of his brothers, dead down there, and he alive up here, and could not push this into any balance. He knew no one would come down the narrows on a night like this, and he went down the stairs again, and away into the back of the kitchen, where the passage started down. The kitchen slaves were asleep around the banked ovens. He took off his shoes to make no noise and kept watch on the yard. In the warmth, he dozed a little. He dreamt of the dwarf, just down at the other end of the passage. He heard himself begging the dwarf to help him. He started awake and heard someone scurry by outside toward the stair. He went up to the front of the kitchen and saw the toad man climbing up the stair. As he went, he drew his dagger. Varn climbed up two steps at a time behind him, his bare feet soundless. At the top, the toad was peering around.
"Looking for me?"
The toad wheeled, his dagger lashing out, but Varn was already driving into him, shoulder first, hurling him back across the narrow walkway. The dagger nicked his cheek. The toad hit the waist-high parapet wall and tumbled over into the air. Varn stood there a moment and heard a thud. Then he went back down the stairs. From the kitchen, the girl called him, and he went in there and lay down with her in the warmth of the hearth. Galdor came out of the hall door. The rain had stopped, and the sunlight blazed bright and clean over the world. To his surprise, across the yard, hacking at a barrel with a sword, was the black-haired boy, Varn Akerson. The king cast a look all around the yard, looking for his man, Githa, and didn't see him. He called Vaughn to him.
I see you made a night of it, he said, when the boy stood before him.
Not much happened, Vaughn said. There was a fresh cut on his cheek.
Galdor said, You didn't see anything?
No. A blowfly bothered me once, but I swatted it away.
Their eyes met. Galdor laid his hand on the hilt of his sword.
Where did you say you came from?
West of here, from the Big Island.
Then how did you get here?
I walked.
On the water?
The boy opened his mouth with another lie. Then, from the tower, the horn blew.
Galdor said a round oath.
Get to the ships, he said. Eldric is come at last.
Vaughn loved being back on the water, where everything was simple. The stroke, his strength, and the sea. On the bench ahead of him, Tulroof swung his oar. Ketil stood at the helm, steering them through the broken water. All around Vaughn, the men were chanting the count. He had rowed all his life, but always clunky little boats like the Knarr. Never before a vessel like this one, this sea serpent of a ship, light and supple, skimming over the water. The rhythm carried him like great wings. He added his voice to the count, a glad part of this. Through the corner of his eye, he could see that they were racing to cut off another longship, streaking up the strait from the west. Ketil yelled out and the count quickened. Vaughn pushed himself to match it, gasping at the effort. All around him, the other men strained at the oars. The ship trashed across a rough current. The oncoming ship was fighting the same surface chop and lost half a length, and then Vaughn's ship glided out onto a patch of easy water. The other longship stood up its oars and veered off. A hoarse cheer rose from the benches around Vaughn. Ketil laid them over. The jug came by and Vaughn gulped down most of the water in it. His sword lay under his bench. Maybe now they would fight, ship to ship. He longed to try the sword in a real fight. Over there, across the open water, the other longship faced them, too far to see any of those men. He dragged in a deep breath. Tulroof reached around and slapped his shoulder, and someone else gave a random yell. Vaughn felt his blood beating through his body. He shook his muscles loose. He looked quickly around at the other men, his crew, his brothers now. He thrust that problem off. He looked out over the water toward the other ship, his hand itching to pick up his sword. Then a horn blew behind them. He twisted to look over his shoulder. Back there, Galdor had his other two ships bowed astern across the narrows. Three more enemy ships lay up the strait, waiting. Lean and low, they were beautiful, and it swelled him to think he would fight in such a one. The horn sounded again, and Vaughn felt his scalp prickle. This was the beginning of it. But none of the other men even looked up. Back at the helm, Ketil suddenly gave over the steerboard to somebody else and went forward. Tulroof was sitting back. Another jug came. Vaughn said, What's going on?
They're talking.
The man across the way from him turned toward him.
Nothing is going to happen for a while.
On the bench behind him, somebody said,
They outnumber us. Galdor doesn't fight against the odds.
Tulroof muttered something under his breath. Vaughn looked around them. They were at the narrowest part of the strait. He remembered the rocks that cluttered the water along the shore. It seemed to him Galdor's three ships could hold off the four enemy ships easily enough. Probably there was some piece of warcraft he was not grasping here. Now Galdor was shouting from his ship toward one of the others, and someone there was shouting back. They were arranging to meet on the land. There would still be a fight. Vaughn reached down to touch the hilt of his sword. Galdor had sent most of his men back up to the Verboy. The rest he kept below, in a broad meadow just inland of the beach, where Hjeldrik's ships drew up, and he went among them and counted out 7 of them. Tolruf was among these 7, and so was Varn. When Ketil was not counted in, he and the others went away. Galdor paced up and down past the men who stayed. He said,
I am staking the Verboy on this. I will reward good work here.
His eyes were hot and bright. He drew his sword. Varn imagined it hissed like a snake coming out of the sheath.
Torulf, take the weather edge. I will take the middle.
Torulf stepped back and leaned on his sword. Around him, the other men were gripping each other's hands, drinking deep of the ale horns. Across the grass, the Eldric's 8 men gathered. Varn looked over his new sword again. He had worked on the rusty parts with sheep's fat and a rag, and gotten some of it clean. The notch he could not fix, but the blade felt good in his hand. He took a deep breath. The sun was warm on his cheek. He told himself he might never see another sunrise. This seemed a far distant, unimportant matter. Tolruf stood there, swinging his arms back and forth. He said,
Is this the first time you've fought like this?
Varn said,
Yes.
His voice had a squeak. Tolruf said,
I think it is my last.
Ketil suddenly appeared again. To Varn he said,
Galdor will win this. Keep your sword up.
He thumped Tolruf on the back.
You'd better get down there. Feed a few ravens for me.
Tolruf walked heavily away across the grass, and Varn followed. Varn could not stop bouncing. He was gripping the sword too tight. Beside him, Tolruf slouched, scratching his beard. He said,
Tonight in Valhalla, Varn Akerson,
and spat through his fingers. Galdor came pacing along in front of them, calling their names and jabbing his sword in the air. He lifted his shield, and the horn blew. They walked together in a row toward Hjeldrik's men, who came toward them in a row, each to each. In front of Varn was a lanky body behind a big round shield, red hair sticking out all around a leather helmet. Varn could not quite get his breath. Beside him, Tolruf gave a screech and dashed forward. The red-headed man lunged at Varn, striking shoulder high, and Varn tore his attention away from Tolruf. He swung up the shield and the blow struck so hard it numbed his arm. He slashed out with his sword, low, not seeing much, and felt it bang hard on the red-headed man's shield, and the other man sprang away. Varn followed him, shield first, wanting him to strike first. Inside the leather helmet, above the thatch of red beard, the man's blue eyes locked with his. He jabbed with his sword, and when Varn pulled his shield up, turned the stroke low and hard. The tip of the sword sliced toward Varn's knee. He drove his own sword down, and the blades rang together. Varn saw at once the other man had the longer reach. He crashed forward, shield first, into the tall, gangly body, closing the gap between them. For an instant, they were chest to chest together, the redhead's breath blasting in Varn's face. He felt the other man's strength coil to throw him off, and as the other man shoved, he slid sideways out of the way, laying out his sword. The red-headed man stumbled, fell across the blade, and staggered to his knees. Varn bellowed, hot with triumph. Then another of Hjeldrik's men was charging him, shorter, wider, swinging an axe. He caught this on the shield, turning the edge a little, so the wide, curved blade did not strike full on. With his sword, he hacked down at the axeman's head. The axeman ducked back and away, and for an instant, Varn could look around. The redhead was getting to his feet. Blood smeared his side, but he was raising his sword again. Out there on the trampled grass, Tolruf lay in a heap. The axeman barked some name, and he and the red-headed man fanned out and came at Varn together. The red-headed man was breathing hard, the blood bright on his breastplate and shield arm. The other man, squatty with his axe, bobbed back and forth, then gave a howl and charged. Varn stood fast. He turned the first blow off with his shield, and with his sword poked and cut, watching how the other man met that. He knew that the red-headed man was coming in behind him, and he backed up in a rush, getting out from between them. The red-headed man dropped to one knee again. The other one lifted his axe, moving sideways, circling around to Varn's far side. The red-headed man heaved himself up onto his feet and stumbled forward. Varn cocked up his shield. His body felt huge and the shield the size of a pea. From the side, the axe sliced at his head, and he ducked and lunged, and his sword glanced off the axeman's shield. He dodged away from them both again, and the axeman stepped back. The red-headed man lost his balance and fell to his hands and knees. Varn cast another look around. They had moved far along the meadow, somehow, almost to the wood. Tallroof's body was a long way back there. Nearer, Galdor and Hjeldrik were circling each other. Galdor's sword swung out, and Hjeldrik dodged, then attacked, going against Galdor's shield hand. Then from the wood there burst a tide of men. Varn stood, startled. They were Galdor's men, and they reached the red-headed man first and hacked him down, and then the axeman went down. Hjeldrik wheeled toward them, and Galdor plunged the sword through his back. Varn did not move. He saw Galdor fling his arms up, triumphant. He saw, down on the beach, two of Hjeldrik's ships push away. Ketil walked up to Varn. He said, "I told you he would not leave it to chance." His eyes did not quite meet Varn's. Varn threw his shield down and went off to see what had happened to Torulf. At Undenmiel, Varn sat staring at his hands. Around him the voices purred and muttered, but he heard nothing. The food came around and he ate nothing. He drank from the ale horn, which did him no good. His mind was churning. Tulrulf was dead, but Tulrulf had died well, of hard wounds taken in front. Varn thought over and over of the red-headed man, who had fought so hard, even wounded, merely to be cut down from behind like a coward. The gall burned in his belly. Ketil, beside him, spoke to him only once. "We won, didn't we?" Varn grunted at him. After that, Ketil said nothing, only glanced at him now and then, and passed him the horn. In the high seat, Galdor shouted out a name, and some warrior stood up, and Galdor pulled one of the gold rings from his arm, and a slave brought it down, and everybody cheered. Varn stared at the table. Then Galdor was calling out his name. Varn lifted his head, and all around saw faces watching him. A slave came trotting toward him, holding out a gold ring, and a long yell rose, his name in 60 voices. He stood up, everybody's eyes turned on him, and hurled the ring across the room.
"No! There was nothing golden on that field! No honor!"
He was shaking, the blood booming in his ears.
"Better men than you died on that field! Galdor, no king! Galdor, cheat! I would be a better king here than you are!"
The hall crashed into silence. Nobody moved. Galdor said,
"This is your end, Varn Akerson."
He rose in his place and took the sword up off the table and drew it from the scabbard. Around Varn, the others were suddenly moving, pulling the benches and tables back, and he was alone, standing there. He drew his sword. Galdor was coming toward him down the hall. He moved away, then Galdor was coming at him, sideways, the keen blade slicing toward him. He bounded backward. He got his sword crosswise of Galdor's, and the shock rang up his arm. Galdor was pushing him along, darting here, there, poking at him, laughing. Varn skittered backward, trying to get some room, and came up against the table. Hands gripped him from behind. Somebody was holding him for Galdor, and the king moved in fast. Varn dropped his sword. He reached back and got the wrists holding him, twisted and crouched down, and with all his weight, he hauled the man behind him over his shoulder and into Galdor's thrust. The sword came out through the falling man's chest. While Galdor was pulling it free, Varn grabbed up his own sword again and vaulted onto the table. The other men shied back toward the walls. Galdor swung hard at his knees, and when he dodged that, the king leapt onto the table after him. Slashing and cutting up and down, he drove Varn backward through the bread and the cheese, tipping over the ale horns. Varn kept his sword up, fending off the king's blows, groping along behind him with his feet. Galdor stabbed at him, and Varn saw something. He lunged toward the weakness, but it was a trap. The king wheeled his blow backward at him and struck the sword out of his hand. A bellow went up. The king's eyes glowed. Varn leapt down from the table and raced out the door into the yard. Galdor was hot after him. Just beyond the threshold was a stack of firewood, and Varn threw a chunk of it at Galdor and saw an axe among the wood. With a bound, he caught it up. Galdor was right behind him, and he wheeled around and swung the axe waist high, missing Galdor by a finger's breadth. Galdor howled. His teeth showed. He hacked right, and Varn dodged, then left, and Varn dodged. The axe was top-heavy and hard to manage. Galdor let him swing and came in behind the swing, and Varn felt the blade crease his ribs through his shirt. He swung the axe around and hurled it straight at Galdor. Galdor went down. The axe grazed his shoulder. Varn raced across the yard, toward the storeroom with the barrel of swords. The doors were shut and barred. Galdor was pounding after him, yelling, derisive.
"Wait, little boy! I'm not done with you!"
Varn swerved toward the kitchen, where there would be knives. Galdor was on his heels. On the ground out in the middle of the yard, he saw a broom and veered toward it. He could hear yelling from a great distance. All he saw was the broom, and he snatched it up and wheeled just as Galdor closed with him. The sword swung at his head. He thrust up the broom, and the blade bit the wood and snapped it. Still clutching the short end, Varn slid back, out of reach of the sword. Galdor stood a moment, the sword raised, the tip circling in the air as if it sniffed for him. The others, packed up against the walls, were calling and whistling. Varn watched only the tip of the sword. Sliding his feet along, the stub end of the broomstick poking out before him, he inched his way toward the wall. Galdor shifted as he shifted, the sword blocking him this way, hurting him that, moving him backward, backward. Varn gave a quick look over his shoulder. Just behind him was the stair up to the parapet. The blade ripped at him, and he sprang backward, up onto the steps. Galdor was below him now, but Varn had no fit weapon. He lashed out with the short piece of the broom, and the king coiled back, out of reach, and whipped the sword at his ankles. Varn leapt up another step, and Galdor came after. The sword jabbed at him. Galdor lunged up the steps, and Varn scurried away across the parapet and came up hard against the rail.
"Nowhere to run now,"
Galdor said, breathless. He lifted the sword, and Varn's gaze rose with it.
"Aha! You admire my sword. You should. It's beyond price. It longs for blood."
He waggled the sword in Varn's face.
"Its first blood was the dwarf who made it, who never made another like it. And now,"
he cocked back the sword above Varn's head,
"it will have yours."
The dwarf. Braced against the wall, Varn cried out,
"Tiraste, remember!"
Galdor swung the blade down at his head, and the sword turned in Galdor's hand, struck the wall, and flew across the parapet. Varn yelled. Galdor lunged after the sword, both hands stretched out. Varn was closer, his hand fastened on the sword hilt, and without pausing, he swung his arm with all his strength around and took Galdor across the body. Somewhere far off, a huge yell went up. Varn stood. Galdor sagged to his knees, his hands on his ripped belly, his head back. Varn said,
"This for my brothers, and Torulf, and the dwarf in the cellar."
He drove the sword through Galdor's chest. The yelling went on. Down in the yard, the other people were shouting and waving their arms. Varn stood, panting. The sword in his hand felt light, quick. Its power burned in it. He understood why Galdor had always been touching it. Varn wanted right away to strike with it again. The dwarf had made it full of charms. He remembered how it had turned on Galdor. He went on down the stair to the yard, crowded with people. They were all watching him, and when he came toward them, they moved back out of his way. He went in through the kitchen. There he found a rushlight, and followed the passageway into the dark. In the forge, at the foot of the stair, he sank down on his heels and held the rushlight up to see. In the dust was the dwarf's head, but now it was smiling. Varn laid the sword down beside it.
"I have brought this back to you,"
the dwarf whispered.
"Yours, yours now."
Eagerly he took it back in his hand. The dwarf's lips bent in a deeper smile.
"But beware, it is still evil."
This was how Varn Akerson became king of the Verboi. But the life there was not to his liking, and soon he went off to join the Yom's Vikings.
George R. R. Martin. Hugo, Nebula, and World Fantasy Award winner George R. R. Martin, New York Times best-selling author of the landmark A Song of Ice and Fire fantasy series, has been called the American Tolkien. Born in Bayonne, New Jersey, George R. R. Martin made his first sale in 1971 and soon established himself as one of the most popular science fiction writers of the 70s. He quickly became a mainstay of the Ben Bova analog with stories such as With Morning Comes Mistfall and Seven Times Never Kill Man, The Second Kind of Loneliness, The Storms of Windhaven, in collaboration with Lisa Tuttle and later expanded by them into the novel Windhaven, Override, and others, although he also sold to Amazing, Fantastic, Galaxy, Orbit, and other markets. One of his analog stories, the striking novella A Song for Leah, won him his first Hugo Award in 1974. By the end of the 70s, he had reached the height of his influence as a science fiction writer and was producing his best work in that category with stories such as the famous Sand Kings, his best-known story which won both the Nebula and the Hugo in 1980. He'd later win another Nebula in 1985 for his story Portraits of His Children. The Way of the Cross and Dragon, which won a Hugo Award in the same year, making Martin the first author ever to receive two Hugo Awards for fiction in the same year, Bitter Blooms, The Stone City, Star Lady, and others. These stories would be collected in Sand Kings, one of the strongest collections of the period. By now he had mostly moved away from analog, although he would have a long sequence of stories about the droll interstellar adventures of Haviland Tuff, later collected in Tuff Voyaging, running throughout the 80s in the Stanley Schmidt analog, as well as a few strong individual pieces such as the novella Night Flyers. Most of his major work of the late 70s and early 80s, though, would appear in Omni. The late 70s and 80s also saw the publication of his memorable novel Dying of the Light, his only solo science fiction novel, while his stories were collected in A Song for Lea, Sand Kings, Songs of Stars and Shadows, Songs the Dead Man Sing, Night Flyers, and Portraits of His Children. By the beginning of the 80s, he'd moved away from science fiction and into the horror genre, publishing the big horror novel Fever Dream and winning the Bram Stoker Award for his horror story The Pear-Shaped Man, and the World Fantasy Award for his werewolf novella The Skin Trade. By the end of that decade, though, the crash of the horror market and the commercial failure of his ambitious horror novel The Armageddon Rag had driven him out of the print world and to a successful career in television instead, where for more than a decade he worked as story editor or producer on such shows as The New Twilight Zone and Beauty and the Beast. After years away, Martin made a triumphant return to the print world in 1996, with the publication of the immensely successful fantasy novel A Game of Thrones, the start of his Song of Ice and Fire sequence. A freestanding novella taken from that work, Blood of the Dragon, won Martin another Hugo Award in 1997. Further books in the Song of Ice and Fire series, A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons, have made it one of the most acclaimed and best-selling series in all of modern fantasy. Recently, the books were made into an HBO TV series, A Game of Thrones, which has become one of the most popular and acclaimed shows on television and made Martin a recognizable figure well outside of the usual genre boundaries, even inspiring a satirical version of him on Saturday Night Live. Martin's recent books include a massive retrospective collection spanning the entire spectrum of his career, Dream Songs, a novella collection, Star Lady and Fast Friend, a novel written in collaboration with Gardner Dozois and Daniel Abraham, Hunter's Run, and as editor, several anthologies edited in collaboration with Gardner Dozois, including Warriors, Song of the Dying Earth, Songs of Love and Death, Down These Strange Streets, Dangerous Women, and Rogues, as well as several new volumes in his long-running Wild Cards anthology series. In 2012, Martin was given the Life Achievement Award by the World Fantasy Convention. His most recent books are High Stakes, the 23rd volume in the Wild Cards series, and The World of Ice and Fire, an illustrated history of the Seven Kingdoms. Here, he takes us to Westeros, home to his Ice and Fire series, and back in time for a look at things that happened long before A Game of Thrones begins, for the story of an unfortunate sibling rivalry that has tragic and disastrous effects on the entire world.
The Sons of the Dragon by George R. R. Martin. King Aegon I Targaryen, as history records, took both of his sisters to wife. Both Visenya and Rhaenys were dragon riders, blessed with the silver-gold hair, purple eyes, and beauty of true Targaryens. Elsewise, the two queens were as unlike one another as any two women could be, save in one other respect. Each of them gave the king a son. Aenys came first. Born in 7 AC to Aegon's younger wife, Queen Rhaenys, the boy was small at birth and sickly. He cried all the time, and it was said that his limbs were spindly and his eyes small and watery, so that the king's maesters feared for his survival. He would spit out the nipples of his wet nurse and give suck only at his mother's breasts, and rumors claimed that he screamed for a fortnight when he was weaned. So unlike King Aegon was he, that a few even dared suggest that his grace was not the boy's true sire, that Aenys was some bastard, born of one of Queen Rhaenys's many handsome favourites, the son of a singer, or a mummer, or a mime. And the prince was slow to grow as well. Not until he was given the young dragon Quicksilver, a hatchling born that year on Dragonstone, did Aenys Targaryen begin to thrive. Prince Aenys was 3 when his mother, Queen Rhaenys, and her dragon Maraxes were slain in Dawn. Her death left the boy prince inconsolable. He stopped eating, and even began to crawl as he had when he was 1, as if he had forgotten how to walk. His father despaired of him, and rumors flew about the court that King Aegon might take another wife, as Rhaenys was dead, and Visenya childless, and perhaps barren. The king kept his own counsel on these matters, so no man could say what thoughts he might have entertained. But many great lords and noble knights appeared at court with their maiden daughters, each more comely than the last. All such speculation ended in 11 AC, when Queen Visenya suddenly announced that she was carrying the king's child. A son, she proclaimed confidently, and so he proved to be. The prince came squalling into the world in 12 AC. No newborn was ever more robust than Maegor Targaryen, maesters and midwives agreed. His weight at birth was almost twice that of his elder brother. The half-brothers were never close. Prince Aenys was the heir apparent, and King Aegon kept him close by his side. As the king moved about the realm from castle to castle, so did the prince. Prince Maegor remained with his mother, sitting by her side when she held court. Queen Visenya and King Aegon were oft apart in those years. When he was not on his royal progress, Aegon would return to King's Landing and the Aegon Fort, whilst Visenya and her son remained on Dragonstone. For this reason, lords and commons alike began to refer to Maegor as the Prince of Dragonstone. Queen Visenya put a sword into her son's hand when he was 3. Supposedly, the first thing he did with the blade was butcher one of the castle cats, men said, though more like this tale was a calumny devised by his enemies many years later. That the prince took to swordplay at once cannot be denied, however. For his master at arms, his mother chose Sir Gawain Corbray, as deadly a knight as could be found in all the 7 kingdoms. Prince Aenys was so oft in his sire's company that his own instruction in the chivalric arts came largely from the knights of Aegon's Kingsguard, and sometimes the king himself. The boy was diligent, his instructors all agreed, and did not want for courage, but he lacked his sire's size and strength, and never showed himself as any more than adequate as a fighter, even when the king pressed Blackfyre into his hands, as he did from time to time. Aenys would not disgrace himself in battle, his tutors told one another, but no songs would ever be sung about his prowess. Such gifts as this prince possessed lay elsewhere. Aenys was a fine singer himself, as it happened, with a strong, sweet voice. He was courteous and charming, clever without being bookish. He made friends easily, and young girls seemed to dote on him, be they high-born or low. Aenys loved to ride as well. His father gave him coursers, palfreys, and destriers, but his favorite mount was his dragon, Quicksilver. Prince Maegor rode as well, but showed no great love for horses, dogs, or any animal. When he was 8, a palfrey kicked him in the stables. Maegor stabbed the horse to death and slashed half the face off the stable boy, who came running at the beast's screams. The Prince of Dragonstone had many companions through the years, but no true friends. He was a quarrelsome boy, quick to take offense, slow to forgive, fearsome in his wrath. His skill with weapons was unmatched, however. A squire at 8, he was unhorsing boys 4 and 5 years his elder in the lists by the time he was 12. And battering seasoned men-at-arms into submission in the castle yard. On his 13th name day, in 25 AC, his mother, Queen Visenya, bestowed her own Valyrian steel blade, Dark Sister, upon him, half a year before his marriage. The tradition amongst the Targaryens had always been to marry kin to kin. Wedding brother to sister was thought to be ideal. Failing that, a girl might wed an uncle, a cousin, or a nephew. A boy, a cousin, aunt, or niece. This practice went back to old Valyria, where it was common amongst many of the ancient families, particularly those who bred and rode dragons. The blood of the dragon must remain pure, the wisdom went. Some of the sorcerer princes also took more than one wife when it pleased them, though this was less common than incestuous marriage. In Valyria before the doom, wise men wrote, 1,000 gods were honored, but none were feared. So few dared to speak against these customs. This was not true in Westeros, where the power of the faith went unquestioned. The old gods were still worshipped in the north, but in the rest of the realm there was a single god with 7 faces, and his voice upon this earth was the High Septon of Old Town. And the doctrines of the faith, handed down through centuries from Andalos itself, condemned the Valyrian marriage customs as practiced by the Targaryens. Incest was denounced as vile sin, whether between father and daughter, mother and son, or brother and sister. And the fruits of such unions were considered abominations in the sight of gods and men. With hindsight, it can be seen that conflict between the faith and House Targaryen was inevitable. Indeed, many amongst the most devout expected the High Septon to speak out against Aegon and his sisters during the conquest, and were most displeased when the Father of the Faithful instead counseled Lord Hightower against opposing the dragon, and even blessed and anointed him at his second coronation. Familiarity is the father of acceptance, it is said. The High Septon who had crowned Aegon the Conqueror remained the shepherd of the faithful until his death in 11 AC, by which time the realm had grown accustomed to the notion of a king with 2 queens, who were both wives and sisters. King Aegon always took care to honor the faith, confirming its traditional rights and privileges, exempting its wealth and property from taxation, and affirming that septons, scepters, and other servants of the 7 accused of wrongdoing could only be tried by the faith's own courts. The accord between the faith and the Iron Throne continued all through the reign of Aegon I. From 11 AC to 37 AC, 6 High Septons wore the Crystal Crown. His Grace remained on good terms with each of them, calling at the Starry Sept each time he came to Old Town. Yet the question of incestuous marriage remained, simmering below the courtesies like poison. Whilst the High Septons of King Aegon's reign never spoke out against the king's marriage to his sisters, neither did they declare it to be lawful. The humbler members of the faith, village septons, holy sisters, begging brothers, poor fellows, still believed it sinful for brother to lie with sister, or for a man to take 2 wives. Aegon the Conqueror had fathered no daughters, however, so these matters did not come to a head at once. The sons of the dragon had no sisters to marry, so each of them was forced to seek elsewhere for a bride. Prince Aenys was the first to marry. In 22 AC, he wed the Lady Alyssa, the maiden daughter of the Lord of the Tides, Aethon Valerian, King Aegon's Lord Admiral and Master of Ships. She was 15, the same age as the prince, and shared his silvery hair and purple eyes as well, for the Valerians were an ancient family descended from Valyrian stock. King Aegon's own mother had been a Valerian, so the marriage was reckoned one of cousin to cousin. It soon proved both happy and fruitful. The following year, Alyssa gave birth to a daughter. Aenys named her Rhaenar, and the realm rejoiced, save perhaps for Queen Visenya. Prince Aenys was the heir to the Iron Throne, all agreed, but now an issue arose as to whether Prince Meagol remained second in the line of succession, or should be considered to have fallen to third, behind the newborn princess. Queen Visenya proposed to settle the matter by betrothing Rhaenyra to Migor, who had just turned 12. Aenys and Alyssa spoke out against the match, however. And when word reached Old Town Starry Sept, the High Septon sent a raven, warning the king that such a marriage would not be looked upon with favor by the faith. He proposed a different bride for Migor, Cerise Hightower, maiden daughter to the Lord of Old Town, and the High Septon's own niece. Aegon, mindful of the advantages of closer ties with Old Town and its ruling house, saw wisdom in the choice and agreed to the match. Thus it came to pass that in 25 AC, Migor Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, wed Lady Cerise Hightower in the Starry Sept of Old Town, with the High Septon himself performing the nuptials. Migor was 13, the bride 10 years his senior. But the lords who bore witness to the bedding all agreed that the prince made a lusty husband, and Migor himself boasted that he had consummated the marriage a dozen times that night. "I made a son for House Targaryen last night," he proclaimed as he broke fast. The son came the next year, but the boy, named Aegon after his grandsire, was born to Lady Alyssa and fathered by Prince Aenys. Lady Cerise did not quicken in the years that followed, though other children came, one after the other, to Alyssa. In 29 AC, she gave Aenys a second son, Viserys. In 34 AC, she gave birth to Jaehaerys, her fourth child and third son. In 36 AC came another daughter, Alysanne. Each son pushed Prince Migor further down in the succession. Some said he stood behind his brother's daughters too. All whilst Migor and Cerise remained childless. On tourney ground and battlefield, however, Prince Migor's accomplishments far exceeded those of his brother. In the great tourney at River Run in 28 AC, Prince Migor unhorsed 3 knights of the Kingsguard in successive tilts before falling to the eventual champion. In the melee, no man could stand before him. Afterward, he was knighted on the field by his father, who dubbed him with no less a blade than Blackfyre. At 10 and 6, Migor became the youngest knight in the 7 kingdoms. Other feats followed. In 29 AC and again in 30 AC, Migor accompanied Osmund Strong and Aethon Valerian to the Stepstones to root out the Lycine pirate king, Sargosso's son, and fought in several bloody affrays, showing himself to be both fearless and deadly. In 31 AC, he hunted down and slew a notorious robber knight in the Riverlands, the so-called Giant of the Trident. Migor was not yet a dragon rider, however. Though 6 hatchlings had been born amidst the fires of Dragonstone in the later years of Aegon's reign, and were offered to the prince, Migor refused them all. His brother's wife teased him about it one day in court, wondering aloud whether, "My good brother is afraid of dragons." Migor darkened in rage at the jape, then replied coolly that there was only one dragon worthy of him. The last 7 years of the reign of Aegon the Conqueror were peaceful ones. After the frustrations of his Dornish War, the king accepted the continued independence of Dorne, and flew to Sunspear on Beleriand on the 10th anniversary of the peace accords to celebrate a feast of friendship with Daria Martell, the reigning princess of Dorne. Prince Aenys accompanied him on Quicksilver. Migor remained on Dragonstone. Aegon had made the 7 kingdoms one with fire and blood, but after celebrating his 60th name day in 33 AC, he turned instead to brick and mortar. 50% of every year was still given over to a royal progress, but now it was Prince Aenys and his wife Alyssa who journeyed from castle to castle, whilst the aging king remained at home, dividing his days between Dragonstone and King's Landing. The fishing village where Aegon had first landed had grown into a sprawling, stinking city of 100,000 souls by that time. Only Old Town and Lannisport were larger. Yet in many ways, King's Landing was still little more than an army camp that had swollen to grotesque size. Dirty, reeking, unplanned, impermanent. And the Aegon Fort, which had spread halfway down Aegon's high hill by that time, was as ugly a castle as any in the Seven Kingdoms. A great confusion of wood and earth and brick that had long outgrown the old log palisades that were its only walls. It was certainly no fit abode for a great king. In 35 AC, Aegon moved with all his court back to Dragonstone and gave orders that the Aegon Fort be torn down so that a new castle might be raised in its place. This time, he decreed, he would build in stone. To oversee the design and construction of the new castle, he named the king's hand Lord Alan Stokeworth. Sir Osmond Strong had died the previous year, and Queen Visenya. A jape went about the court that King Aegon had given Visenya charge of building the Red Keep, so he would not have to endure her presence on Dragonstone. Aegon the Conqueror died of a stroke on Dragonstone in the 37th year after the conquest. His grandsons, Aegon and Viserys, were with him at his death in the chamber of the Painted Table. The king was showing them the details of his conquests. Prince Maegor, in residence at Dragonstone at the time, spoke the eulogy as his father's body was laid upon a funeral pyre in the castle yard. The king was clad in battle armor, his mailed hands folded over the hilt of Blackfyre. Since the days of old Valyria, it had ever been the custom of House Targaryen to burn their dead, rather than consigning their remains to the ground. Vhagar supplied the flames to light the fire. Blackfyre was burned with the king, but retrieved by Aenys afterward, its blade darker, but elsewise unharmed. No common fire can damage Valyrian steel. The dragon was survived by his sister Visenya, his sons Aenys and Maegor, and five grandchildren. Prince Aenys was 30 years of age at his father's death, Prince Maegor 25. Aenys had been at Highgarden on his progress when his father died, but Quicksilver returned him to Dragonstone for the funeral. Afterward, he donned his father's iron and ruby crown, and Grand Maester Garwin proclaimed him Aenys of House Targaryen, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, and Protector of the Realm. The lords and knights and septons who had come to Dragonstone to bid their king farewell knelt and bowed their heads. When Prince Meagor's turn came, Aenys drew him back to his feet, kissed his cheek and said, "Brother, you need never kneel to me again. We shall rule this realm together, you and I." Then the king presented his father's sword, Blackfyre, to his brother, saying, "You are more fit to bear this blade than me. Wield it in my service, and I shall be content." Afterward, the new king sailed to King's Landing, where he found the Iron Throne standing amidst mounds of rubble and mud. The old Aegon Fort had been torn down, and pits and tunnels pockmarked the hill, where the cellars and foundations of the Red Keep were being dug. But the new castle had not yet begun to rise. Nonetheless, thousands came to cheer King Aenys as he claimed his father's seat for his own. Thereafter, his grace set out for Old Town to receive the blessing of the High Septon, travelling by way of Riverrun, Lannisport, and Highgarden on a grand royal progress. His wife and children made the journey with him, and all along the route the small folk appeared by the hundreds and thousands to hail their new king and queen. At the Starry Sept, the High Septon anointed him as he had his father, and presented him with a crown of yellow gold, with the faces of the seven inlaid in jade and pearl. Yet even as Aenys was receiving the High Septon's blessing, some were casting doubt on his fitness to sit the Iron Throne. Westeros required a warrior, not a dreamer, they whispered to one another, and Prince Maegor was the stronger of the dragon's two sons. And foremost amongst the whisperers was Maegor's mother, the Dowager Queen Visenya Targaryen. The truth is plain enough, she is reported to have said. Even Aenys sees it. Why else would he have given Blackfyre to my son? He knows that only Maegor has the strength to rule. The young king's mettle would be tested sooner than anyone could have imagined. The wars of conquest had left scars throughout the realm. Sons now come of age dreamed of avenging long-dead fathers. Knights remembered the days when a man with a sword and a horse and a suit of armor could slash his way to riches and glory. Lords recalled a time when they did not need a king's leave to tax their small folk or kill their enemies. The chains the dragon forged can yet be broken, the discontented told one another. We can win our freedoms back, but now is the time to strike, for this new king is weak. The first stirrings of revolt were in the Riverlands, amidst the colossal ruins of Harrenhal. Aegon had granted the castle to Sir Quentin Coherus, his old master at arms. When Lord Coherus died in a fall from his horse in 9 AC, his title passed to his grandson Gargon, a fat and foolish man with an unseemly appetite for young girls, who became known as Gargon the Guest. Lord Gargon soon became infamous for turning up at every wedding celebrated within his domains, so that he might enjoy the Lord's right of first night. A more unwelcome wedding guest can scarce be imagined. He also made free with the wives and daughters of his own servants. King Aenys was still on his progress, guesting with Lord Tully of Riverrun, when the father of a maid Lord Coherus had ruined opened a postern gate at Harrenhal to an outlaw who styled himself Harren the Red and claimed to be a grandson of Harren the Black. The outlaws pulled his lordship from his bed and dragged him to the castle Godswood, where Harren sliced off his genitals and fed them to a dog. A few leal men-at-arms were killed. The rest agreed to join Harren, who declared himself Lord of Harrenhal and King of the Rivers. Not being ironborn, he did not claim the islands. When word reached Riverrun, Lord Tully urged the king to mount Quicksilver and descend on Harrenhal as his father had. But his grace, perhaps mindful of his mother's death in Dawn, instead commanded Tully to gather his banners and lingered at Riverrun as they gathered. Only when 1,000 men were assembled did Aenys march. But when his men reached Harrenhal, they found it empty, but for corpses. Harren the Red had put Lord Gargon's leal servants to the sword and taken his band into the woods. By the time Aenys returned to King's Landing, the news had grown even worse. In the Vale, Lord Ronald Arryn's younger brother, Jonos, had deposed and imprisoned his loyal sibling and declared himself King of Mountain and Vale. In the Iron Islands, another priest king had walked out of the sea, announcing himself to be Lodos, the twice drowned, the son of the drowned god, returned at last from visiting his father. And high in the red mountains of Dawn, a pretender called the Vulture King appeared, and called on all true Dornishmen to avenge the evils visited on Dawn by the Targaryens. Though Princess Daria denounced him, swearing that she and all leal Dornishmen wanted only peace, thousands flocked to his banners, swarming down from the hills and up out of the sands, through goat tracks in the mountains, into the reach.
This Vulture King is half mad, and his followers are a rabble, undisciplined and unwashed,
Lord Harmon Dondarrion wrote to the king.
We can smell them coming 50 leagues away.
Not long after, that selfsame rabble stormed and seized his castle of Blackhaven. The Vulture King personally sliced off Dondarrion's nose before putting Blackhaven to the torch and marching away. King Aenys knew these rebels had to be put down, but seemed unable to decide where to begin. Grand Maester Garwin wrote that the king seemed unable to comprehend why this was happening. The small folk loved him, did they not? Jonos Aeryn, this new Lodos, the Vulture King. Had he wronged them? If they had grievances, why not bring them to him? I would have heard them out, he said. He spoke of sending messengers to the rebels to learn the reasons for their actions. Fearing that King's Landing might not be safe with Heron the Red alive and near, he sent his wife and children to Dragonstone. He commanded his hand, Lord Alan Stokeworth, to take a fleet and army to the Vale to put down Jonos Aeryn and restore his brother Ronald to the lordship. But when the ships were about to sail, he countermanded the order, fearing that Stokeworth's departure would leave King's Landing undefended. Instead, he sent the Hand with but a few hundred men to hunt down Heron the Red, and decided he would summon a great council to discuss how best to put down the other rebels. Whilst the king prevaricated, his lords took to the field. Some acted on their own authority, others in concert with the Dowager Queen. In the Vale, Lord Allard Royce of Runestone assembled 20 loyal lords and marched against the Eyrie, easily defeating the supporters of the self-styled King of Mountain and Vale. But when they demanded the release of their rightful lord, Jonos Aeryn sent his brother to them through the Moon Door. Such was the sad end of Ronald Aeryn, who had flown thrice about the giant's lance on Dragonback. The Eyrie was impregnable to any conventional assault, so King Jonos and his diehard followers spat down defiance at the loyalists and settled in for a siege. Until Prince Migor appeared in the sky above, astride Beleriand. The Conqueror's son had claimed a dragon at last, and none other than the Black Dread, the greatest of them all. Rather than face his fires, the Eyrie's garrison seized the pretender and delivered him to Lord Royce, opening the Moon Door once again and serving Jonos the Kinslayer as he had served his brother. Surrender saved the pretender's followers from burning, but not from death. After taking possession of the Eyrie, Prince Migor executed them to a man. Even the highest born amongst them were denied the honor of dying by sword. Traitors deserved only a rope, Migor decreed, so the captured knights were hanged naked from the walls of the Eyrie, kicking as they strangled slowly. Hubert Aeryn, a cousin to the dead brothers, was installed as Lord of the Vale. As he had already sired 6 sons by his lady wife, a Royce of Runestone, the Aeryn succession was seen to be secure. In the Iron Islands, Gorin Greyjoy, Lord Reaper of Pike, brought King Lodos, second of that name, to a similar swift end, marshalling 100 longships to descend on Old Wick and Great Wick, where the pretender's followers were most numerous, and putting thousands of them to the sword. Afterward, he had the head of the Priest King pickled in brine and sent to King's Landing. King Aenys was so pleased by the gift that he offered Greyjoy any boon he might desire. This proved unwise. Lord Gorin, wishing to prove himself a true son of the drowned god, asked the king for the right to expel all the septons and scepters who had come to the Iron Islands after the conquest to convert the Ironborn to the worship of the Seven. King Aenys had no choice but to agree. The largest and most threatening rebellion remained that of the Vulture King along the Dornish marches. Though Princess Deria continued to issue denunciations from Sunspear, there were many who suspected that she was playing a double game, for she did not take the field against the rebels and was rumored to be sending them men, money, and supplies. Whether that was true or not, hundreds of Dornish knights and several thousand seasoned spearmen had joined the Vulture King's rabble, and the rabble itself had swelled enormously to more than 30,000 men. So large had his host become that the Vulture King made an ill-considered decision and divided his strength. Whilst he marched west against Nightsong and Horn Hill, with half the Dornish power, the other half went east to besiege Stonehelm, seat of House Swan, under the command of Lord Walter Will, the son of the Widow Lover. Both hosts met with disaster. Orys Baratheon, known now as Orys Onehand, rode forth from Storm's End one last time to smash the Dornish beneath the walls of Stonehelm. When Walter Will was delivered into his hands, wounded but alive, Lord Orys said, "Your father took my hand. I claim yours as repayment." So saying, he hacked off Lord Walter's sword hand. Then he took his other hand and both his feet as well, calling them his usury. Strange to say, Lord Baratheon died on the march back to Storm's End of the wounds he himself had taken during the battle. But his son Davos always said he died content, smiling at the rotting hands and feet that dangled in his tent like a string of onions. The Vulture King himself fared little better. Unable to capture Nightsong, he abandoned the siege and marched west, only to have Lady Charon sally forth behind him, to join up with the strong force of marchmen led by Harman Dondarrion, the mutilated Lord of Blackhaven. Meanwhile, Lord Samwell Tarly of Horn Hill suddenly appeared athwart the Dornish line of march with several thousand knights and archers. Savage Sam, that lord was called, and so he proved in the bloody battle that ensued, cutting down dozens of Dornishmen with his great Valyrian steel blade, Heartsbane. The Vulture King had twice as many men as his three foes combined, but most were untrained and undisciplined, and when faced with armored knights at front and rear, their ranks shattered. Throwing down their spears and shields, the Dornish broke and ran, making for the distant mountains. But the Marcher Lords rode after them and cut them down, in what became known after as the Vulture Hunt. As for the Rebel King himself, the man who called himself the Vulture King was taken alive and tied naked between two posts by Savage Sam Tarly. The singers like to say that he was torn to pieces by the very vultures from whom he took his style. But in truth, he perished of thirst and exposure, and the birds did not descend on him until well after he was dead. In later centuries, several other men would take the title Vulture King, but whether they were of the same blood as the first, no man can say. The first of the rebels proved to be the last as well, but Heron the Red was at last brought to bay in a village west of the God's Eye. The outlaw king did not die meekly. In his last fight, he slew the king's hand, Lord Alan Stokeworth, before being cut down by Stokeworth's squire, Branar Brun. A grateful King Aenys conferred knighthood on Brun and rewarded Davos Baratheon, Samwell Tarly, No-Nose Dondarrion, Elin Caron, Allard Royce, and Gorin Greyjoy with gold, offices, and honours. The greatest plaudits he bestowed on his own brother. On his return to King's Landing, Prince Migor was hailed as a hero. King Aenys embraced him before a cheering throng and named him Hand of the King. And when two young dragons hatched amidst the fire pits of Dragonstone at the end of that year, it was taken for a sign. But the amity between the dragon's sons did not long endure. It may be that conflict was inevitable, for the two brothers had very different natures. Kind-hearted and soft-spoken, it was said of King Aenys that he loved his wife, his children, and his people, and wished only to be loved in turn. sword and lance, had long ago lost whatever appeal they ever had for him. Instead, his grace dabbled in alchemy, astronomy, and astrology, delighted in music and dance, wore the finest silks, samites, and velvets, and enjoyed the company of maesters, septons, and wits. His brother Migor, taller, broader, and fearsomely strong, had no patience for any of that, but lived for war, tourneys, and battle. He was rightly regarded as one of the finest knights in Westeros, though his savagery in the field and his harshness toward defeated foes was oft remarked upon as well. King Aenys sought always to please. When faced with difficulties, he would answer with soft words, whereas Migor's reply was ever steel and fire. Grand Maester Garwin wrote that Aenys trusted everyone, Migor no one. The king was easily influenced, Garwin observed, swaying this way and that like a reed into the wind, like as not to heed whichever counsellor last had his ear. Prince Migor, on the other hand, was rigid as an iron rod, unyielding, unbending. Despite such differences, the Sons of the Dragon continued to rule together amicably for the best part of 2 years. But in 39 AC, Queen Alyssa gave King Aenys yet another heir, a girl she named Vela, who sadly died in the cradle not long after. Perhaps it was this continued proof of the queen's fertility that drove Prince Migor to do what he did. Whatever the reason, the prince shocked the realm and the king both when he suddenly announced that Lady Cerise was barren, and he had therefore taken a second wife in Alice Haraway, daughter of the new lord of Harrenhal. The wedding was performed on Dragonstone, under the aegis of the Dowager Queen Visenya. As the castle septon refused to officiate, Migor and his new bride were wed in a Valyrian rite, wed by blood and fire. The marriage took place without the leave, knowledge, or presence of King Aenys. When it became known, the two half-brothers quarrelled bitterly. Nor was his grace alone in his wrath. Lord Hightower, father of Lady Cerise, made protest to the king, demanding that Lady Alice be put aside. And in the Sari Sept at Oldtown, the High Septon went even further, denouncing Migor's marriage as sin and fornication, and calling the prince's new bride, "This whore of Haraway." No true son or daughter of the Seven would ever bow to such, he thundered. Prince Migor remained defiant. His father had taken both of his sisters to wife, he pointed out. The strictures of the faith might rule lesser men, but not the blood of the dragon. No words of King Aenys could heal the wound his brother's words thus opened, and many pious lords throughout the Seven Kingdoms condemned the marriage and began to speak openly of Migor's whore. Vexed and angry, King Aenys gave his brother a choice. Put Alice Haraway aside and return to Lady Cerise, or suffer 5 years of exile. Prince Migor chose exile. In 40 AC, he departed for Pentos, taking Lady Alice, Beleriand his dragon, and the sword Blackfyre. It is said that Aenys requested that his brother return Blackfyre, to which request Prince Migor replied, "Your grace is welcome to try and take her from me." Lady Cerise was left abandoned in King's Landing. To replace his brother as hand, King Aenys turned to Septon Murmurson, a pious cleric said to be able to heal the sick by the laying on of hands. The king had him lay hands on Lady Cerise's belly every night, in the hopes that his brother might repent his folly, if his lawful wife could be made fertile. But the lady soon grew weary of the nightly ritual, and departed King's Landing for Oldtown, where she rejoined her father in the High Tower. No doubt his grace hoped the choice would appease the faith. If so, he was wrong. Septon Murmurson could no more heal the realm than he could make Cerise Hightower fecund. The High Septon continued to thunder, and all through the realm the lords in their halls spoke of the king's weakness. How can he rule the Seven Kingdoms when he cannot even rule his brother? It was said. Yet the king remained strangely oblivious to the discontent in the realm. Peace had returned. His troublesome brother was safely out of sight across the narrow sea, and a great new castle had begun to rise atop Aegon's high hill. Built all in pale red stone, the king's new seat would be larger and more lavish than Dragonstone, more beautiful than Harrenhal, with massive walls and barbicans and towers, capable of withstanding any enemy. The Red Keep, the people of King's Landing named it. Its building had become the king's obsession. "My descendants shall rule from here for 1,000 years, his grace declared. And thinking of those descendants, in 41 AC, Aenys Targaryen made a disastrous blunder and gave the hand of his daughter Rhaenar in marriage to her brother Aegon, heir to the Iron Throne. The princess was 18, the prince 15. A royal wedding is a joyous event, the occasion for celebration, but this was the sort of incestuous union that the High Septon had warned against, and the Starry Sept condemned it as an obscenity, and warned that children born of it would be abominations in the sight of gods and men. On the day of the wedding, the streets outside the Sept of Remembrance, built by a previous High Septon atop the Hill of Rhaenys and named in honor of the fallen queen, were lined with warriors' sons in gleaming silver armor, scowling at the wedding guests as they passed by, afoot, a horse, or in litters. The wiser lords, perhaps expecting that, had stayed away. Those who did come to bear witness saw more than a wedding. At the feast afterward, King Aenys compounded his misjudgment by granting the title Prince of Dragonstone to his heir Aegon. A hush fell over the hall at those words, for all present knew that title had hitherto belonged to Prince Maegor. At the high table, Queen Visenya rose and stalked from the hall without the king's leave. That night, she mounted Vhagar and returned to Dragonstone. And it is written that when her dragon passed before the moon, that orb turned as red as blood. Aenys Targaryen did not seem to comprehend the extent to which he had roused the realm against him. Thinking to win back the favor of the small folk, he sent Aegon and Rhaenar on a royal progress, only to find that they were jeered wherever they went. Septon Murmerson, his hand, was expelled from the faith in punishment for performing the nuptials, whereupon the king wrote to the High Septon, asking that his High Holiness restore my good Murmerson, and explaining the long history of brother-sister marriages in old Valyria. The High Septon's reply was so blistering that his grace went pale when he read it. Far from relenting, the Shepherd of the Faithful addressed Aenys as King Abomination, declared him a pretender and a tyrant, with no right to rule the Seven Kingdoms. The Faithful were listening. Less than a fortnight later, as Septon Murmerson was crossing the city in his litter, a group of poor fellows came swarming from an alley and hacked him to pieces with their axes. The warrior's sons began to fortify the Hill of Rhaenys, turning the Sept of Remembrance into their citadel. With the Red Keep still years away from completion, the king decided that his manse atop Visenya's hill was too vulnerable, and made plans to remove himself to Dragonstone with King Alyssa and their younger children. It was a wise precaution. 3 days before they were to sail, two poor fellows scaled the manse's walls and broke into the king's bedchamber. Only the timely intervention of Sir Raymond Baratheon of the king's guard saved Aenys from death. His grace was trading Visenya's hill for Visenya herself. On Dragonstone, the Queen Dowager famously greeted him with, "You are a fool and a weakling, nephew."
Do you think any man would ever have dared speak so to your father? You have a dragon. Use him. Fly to Old Town and make this Starry Sept another Harrenhal. Or give me leave and let me roast this pious fool for you. Vhagar grows old, but her fires still burn hot. Aenys would not hear of it. Instead, he sent the Queen Dowager to her chambers in Sea Dragon Tower and ordered her to remain there. By the end of 41 AC, much of the realm was deep in the throes of a full-fledged rebellion against House Targaryen. The four false kings who had risen on the death of Aegon the Conqueror now seemed like so many posturing fools against the threat posed by this new rising. For these rebels believed themselves soldiers of the Seven, fighting a holy war against godless tyranny. Dozens of pious lords throughout the Seven Kingdoms took up the cry, pulling down the king's banners and declaring for the Starry Sept. The warrior's son seized the gates of King's Landing, giving them control over who might enter and leave the city, and drove the workmen from the unfinished Red Keep. Thousands of poor fellows took to the roads, forcing travellers to declare whether they stood with the gods or the abomination, and remonstrating outside castle gates until their lords came forth to denounce the Targaryen king. Prince Aegon and his wife were forced to abandon their progress and take shelter in Crakehall Castle. An envoy from the Iron Bank of Braavos, sent to Old Town to treat with Lord Hightower, wrote to the bank to say that the High Septon was the true king of Westeros in all but name. The corning of the new year found King Aenys still on Dragonstone, sick with fear and indecision. His grace was but 35 years of age, but it was said that he looked like a man of 60. And Grand Maester Garwin reported that he oft took to his bed with loose bowels and stomach cramps. When none of the Grand Maester's cures proved efficacious, the Dowager Queen took charge of the king's care, and Aenys seemed to improve for a time, only to suffer a sudden collapse when word reached him that thousands of poor fellows had surrounded Crake Hall, where his son and daughter were reluctant guests. 3 days later, the king was dead. Like his father, Aenys Targaryen, the first of his name, was given over to the flames in the yard at Dragonstone. His funeral was attended by his sons Viserys and Jaehaerys, 12 and 7 years of age respectively, and his daughter Alysanne, 5. Queen Alyssa sang a dirge for him. The Dowager Queen Visenya was not present. Within an hour of the king's death, she had mounted Vhagar and flown east, across the narrow sea. When she returned, Prince Maegor was with her, on Beleriand. Maegor descended on Dragonstone only long enough to claim the crown. Not the ornate golden crown Aenys had favoured, with its images of the Seven, but the iron crown of their father, set with its blood-red rubies. His mother placed it on his head, and the lords and knights gathered there knelt as he proclaimed himself Maegor of House Targaryen, first of his name, king of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and protector of the realm. Only Grand Maester Garwin dared object. By all the laws of inheritance, laws that the Conqueror himself had affirmed after the conquest, the Iron Throne should pass to King Aenys's son Aegon, the aged maester said. The Iron Throne will go to the man who has the strength to seize it, Maegor replied. Whereupon he decreed the immediate execution of the Grand Maester, taking off Garwin's old grey head himself with a single swing of Blackfyre. Queen Alyssa and her children were not on hand to witness King Maegor's coronation. She had taken them from Dragonstone within hours of her husband's funeral, crossing to her lord father's castle on nearby Driftmark. When told, Maegor gave a shrug, then retired to the chamber of the painted table with a maester, to dictate letters to lords great and small throughout the realm. 100 ravens flew within the day. The next day, Migor flew as well. Mounting Beleriand, he crossed Blackwater Bay to King's Landing, accompanied by the Dowager Queen Visenya upon Vhagar. The return of the dragons set off riots in the city, as hundreds tried to flee, only to find the gates closed and barred. The warrior's sons held the city walls, the chaos that would be the Red Keep and the Hill of Rhaenys, where they had made the Sept of Remembrance their own fortress. The Targaryens raised their standards atop Visenya's hill and called for leal men to gather to them. Thousands did. Visenya Targaryen proclaimed that her son Migor had come to be their king. A true king, blood of Aegon the Conqueror, who was my brother, my husband, and my love. If any man questions my son's right to the Iron Throne, let him prove his claim with his body. The warrior's sons were not slow to accept her challenge. Down from the hill of Rhaenys they rode, 700 knights in silvered steel, led by their grand captain, Sir Daemon Morrigan, called Daemon the Devout. Let us not bandy words, Migor told him. Swords will decide this matter. Sir Daemon agreed. The gods would grant victory to him whose cause was just, he said. Let each side have 7 champions, as it was done in Andalos of old. Can you find 6 men to stand beside you? For Aenys had taken the Kingsguard to Dragonstone, and Migor stood alone. The king turned to the crowd. Who will come and stand beside his king? He called. Many turned away in fear, or pretended that they did not hear, for the prowess of the warrior's sons was known to all. But at last, one man offered himself. No knight, but a simple man-at-arms who called himself Dick Bean. I've been a king's man since I was a boy, he said. I mean to die a king's man. Only then did the first knight step forward. This Bean shames us all, he shouted. Are there no true knights here? No leal men? The speaker was Branagh Brun, the squire who had slain Heron the Red and been knighted by King Aenys himself. His scorn drove others to offer their swords. The names of the 4 Migor chose are writ large in the history of Westeros. Sir Bram of Blackhall, a hedge knight. Sir Rayford Rosby. Sir Guy Lothstone, called Guy the Glutton, and Sir Lucifer Massey, Lord of Stonedance. The names of the 7 warrior sons have likewise come down to us. They were Sir Daemon Morrigan, called Daemon the Devout, Grand Captain of the Warrior's Sons. Sir Lyle Bracken. Sir Harris Horp, called Deathshead Harry. Sir Aegon Ambrose. Sir Dickon Flowers, the Bastard of Beesbury. Sir Willem the Wanderer, and Sir Garibald of the 7 Stars, the Septon Knight. It is written that Daemon the Devout led a prayer, beseeching the warrior to grant strength to their arms. Afterward, the Queen Dowager gave the command to begin. And the issue was joined. Dick Bean died first, cut down by Lyle Bracken mere instants after the combat began. Thereafter, accounts differ markedly. One chronicler says that when the hugely fat Sir Guy the Glutton was cut open, the remains of 40 half-digested pies spilled out. Another claims Sir Garibald of the 7 Stars sang a paean as he fought. Several tell us that Lord Massey hacked off the arm of Harris Horp. In one account, Deathshead Harry tossed his battle axe into his other hand and buried it between Lord Massey's eyes. Other chroniclers suggest Sir Harris simply died. Some say the fight went on for hours, others that most of the combatants were down and dying in mere moments. All agree that great deeds were done and mighty blows exchanged, until the end found Migor Targaryen standing alone against Daemon the Devout and William the Wanderer. Both of the warrior's sons were badly wounded, and his grace had Blackfyre in his hand. But even so, it was a near thing. The singers and maesters are agreed. Even as he fell, Sir Willem dealt the king a terrible blow to the head that cracked his helm and left him insensate. Many thought Meagher dead as well, until his mother removed his broken helm.
"The king breathes," she proclaimed. "The king lives."
The victory was his. Seven of the mightiest of the warrior's sons were dead, including their commander, but more than 700 remained, armed and armored, and gathered about the crown of the hill. Queen Visenya commanded her son to be taken to the maesters. As the litter bearers bore him down the hill, the swords of the faith dropped to their knees in submission. The Dowager Queen ordered them to return to their fortified sept atop the hill of Rhaenys. For 27 days, Migor Targaryen lingered at the point of death, whilst maesters treated him with potions and poultices, and septons prayed above his bed. In the Sept of Remembrance, the warrior's sons prayed as well, and argued about their course. Some felt the Order had no choice but to accept Migor as king, since the gods had blessed him with victory. Others insisted that they were bound by oath to obey the High Septon and fight on. The Kingsguard arrived from Dragonstone in the nonce. At the command of the Dowager Queen, they took command of the thousands of Targaryen loyalists in the city and surrounded the Hill of Rhaenys. On Driftmark, the widowed Queen Alyssa proclaimed her own son Aegon the true king. In the Citadel of Old Town, the Archmaesters met in conclave to debate the succession and choose a new Grand Maester. Thousands of poor fellows streamed toward King's Landing. Those from the west followed the hedge knight Sir Horace Hill. Those from the south, a gigantic axeman called Wat the Hewer. When the ragged bands encamped about Castle Crakehall left to join their fellows on the march, Prince Aegon and Princess Rhaenyra were finally able to depart. Abandoning their royal progress, they made their way to Casterly Rock, where Lord Lyman Lannister offered them his protection. It was his wife, the Lady Jocasta, who first discerned that Princess Rhaenyra was with child. On the 28th day after the Trial of Seven, a ship arrived from Pentos upon the evening tide, carrying 2 women and 600 sellswords. Alice of House Heroway, Migor Targaryen's second wife, had returned to Westeros, but not alone. With her sailed another woman, a pale, raven-haired beauty known only as Tyana of the Tower. Some said the woman was Migor's concubine. Others named her Lady Alice's paramour. The natural daughter of a Pentoshi magister, Tyana was a tavern dancer who had risen to be a courtesan. She was rumored to be a poisoner and sorceress as well. Many queer tales were told about her. Yet as soon as she arrived, Queen Visenya dismissed her son's maesters and septons and gave Migor over to Tyana's care. The next morning, the king awoke, rising with the sun. When Migor appeared on the walls of the Red Keep, standing between Alice Hareaway and Tyana of Pentos, the crowds cheered wildly, and the city erupted in celebration. But the revels died away when Migor mounted Beleriand and descended upon the Hill of Rhaenys, where 700 of the warrior's sons were at their morning prayers in the fortified sept. As Dragonfire set the building aflame, archers and spearmen waited outside for those who came bursting through the doors. It was said the screams of the burning men could be heard throughout the city, and a pall of smoke lingered over King's Landing for days. Thus did the cream of the warrior's sons meet their fiery end. Though other chapters remained in Old Town, Lannisport, Gulltown, and Stony Sept, the Order would never again approach its former strength. King Migor's war against the Faith Militant had just begun, however. It would continue for the remainder of his reign. The king's first act upon resuming the Iron Throne was to command the poor fellows swarming toward the city to lay down their weapons, under penalty of proscription and death. When his decree had no effect, his grace commanded all leal lords to take the field and disperse the faith's ragged hordes by force. In response, the High Septon in Oldtown called upon true and pious children of the gods to take up arms in defense of the faith and put an end to the reign of dragons and monsters and abominations. Battle was joined first in the Reach at the town of Stonebridge. There, 9,000 poor fellows under Wat the Hewer found themselves caught between six lordly hosts as they attempted to cross the Mander. With half his men north of the river and half on the south, Wat's army was cut to pieces. His untrained and undisciplined followers, clad in boiled leather, rough spun, and scraps of rusted steel, and armed largely with woodsmen's axes, sharpened sticks, and farm implements, proved utterly unable to stand against the charge of armored knights on heavy horses. So grievous was the slaughter that the Mander ran red for 20 leagues, and thereafter the town and castle where the battle had been fought became known as Bitterbridge. Wat himself was taken alive, though not before slaying half a dozen knights, amongst them Lodowes of Grassyvale, commander of the king's host. The giant was delivered to King's Landing in chains. By then, Sir Horace Hill had reached the great fork of the Blackwater with an even larger host. Close on 13,000 poor fellows, their ranks stiffened by the addition of 200 mounted warrior's sons from Stony Sept, and the household knights and feudal levies of a dozen rebel lords from the Westerlands and Riverlands. Lord Rupert Falwell, famed as the Fighting Fool, led the ranks of the pious who had answered the High Septon's call. With him rode Sir Lionel Lorch, Sir Alan Terrick, Lord Christopher Wayne, Lord John Leicester, and many other puissant knights. The army of the faithful numbered 20,000 men. King Migor's army was of like size, however, and his grace had almost twice as much armored horse, as well as a large contingent of longbowmen, and the king himself riding Balerion. Even so, the battle proved a savage struggle. The Fighting Fool slew two knights of the king's guard before he himself was cut down by the Lord of Maidenpool. Big John Hogg, fighting for the king, was blinded by a sword slash early in the battle, yet rallied his men and led a charge that broke through the lines of the faithful and put the poor fellows to flight. A rainstorm dampened Balerion's fires, but could not quench them entirely. And amid smoke and screams, King Migor descended again and again to serve his foes with flame. By nightfall, victory was his, as the remaining poor fellows threw down their axes and streamed away in all directions. Triumphant, Migor returned to King's Landing to seat himself once more upon the Iron Throne. When Wat the Hewer was delivered to him, chained yet still defiant, Migor took off his limbs with the giant's own axe, but commanded his maesters to keep the man alive,
so he might attend my wedding.
Then his grace announced his intent to take Tyana of Pentos as his third wife. Though it was whispered that his mother, the Queen Dowager, had no love for the Pentoshi sorceress, only Grand Maester Myers dared speak against her openly.
"Your one true wife awaits you in the High Tower," Myers said.
The king heard him out in silence, then descended from the throne, drew Blackfyre, and slew him where he stood. Migor Targaryen and Tyana of the Tower were wed atop the hill of Rhaenys, amidst the ashes and bones of the warrior's sons who had died there. It was said that Migor had to put a dozen septons to death before he found one willing to perform the ceremony. Wat the Hewer, limbless, was kept alive to witness the marriage. King Aenys's widow, Queen Alyssa, was present as well with her younger sons, Viserys and Jaehaerys, and her daughter, Alysanne. A visit from the Dowager Queen and Vhagar had persuaded her to leave her sanctuary on Driftmark and return to court, where Alyssa and her brothers and cousins of House Valyrian did homage to Maegor as the true king. The widowed queen was even compelled to join the other ladies of the court in disrobing his grace and escorting him to the nuptial chamber to consummate his marriage, a bedding ceremony presided over by the king's second wife, Alice Haraway. That task done, Alyssa and the other ladies took their leave of the royal bedchamber, but Alice remained, joining the king and his newest wife in a night of carnal lust. Across the realm in Old Town, the High Septon was loud in his denunciations of the abomination and his whores, whilst the king's first wife, Cerise of House Hightower, continued to insist that she was Maegor's only lawful queen. And in the Westerlands, Aegon Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone, remained adamant as well. As the eldest son of King Aenys, the Iron Throne was his by right. Prince Aegon was but 17, however, and the son of a weak father besides. Few lords cared to risk King Maegor's wrath by supporting his claim. His own mother, Queen Alyssa, had abandoned his cause, men whispered to each other. Even Lyman Lannister, the prince's host, would not pledge his sword to the young pretender, though he did stand firm when Maegor demanded that Aegon and his sister be expelled from Casterly Rock. And thus it was there at Casterly Rock that Princess Rhaenyra gave birth to Aegon's daughters, twins they named Arya and Rhaella. From the Starry Sept came another blistering proclamation. These children too were abominations, the High Septon proclaimed, the fruits of lust and incest, and accursed of the gods. The dawn of the year 43 AC found King Maegor in King's Landing, where he had taken personal charge of the construction of the Red Keep. Much of the finished work was now undone or changed. New builders and workmen were brought in, and secret passages and tunnels crept through the depths of Aegon's high hill. As the red stone towers rose, the king commanded the building of a castle within the castle, a fortified redoubt surrounded by a dry moat that would soon be known to all as Maegor's Holdfast. In that same year, Maegor made Lord Lucas Haraway, father of his wife Queen Alice, his new hand. But it was not the hand who had the king's ear. His grace might rule the Seven Kingdoms, men whispered, but he himself was ruled by the three queens. His mother, Queen Visenya, his paramour, Queen Alice, and the Pentashe witch, Queen Tyana. The Mistress of Whispers, Tyana was called, and the King's Raven, for her black hair. She spoke with rats and spiders, it was said, and all the vermin of King's Landing came to her by night to tell tales of any fool rash enough to speak against the king. Meanwhile, thousands of poor fellows still haunted the roads and wild places of the Reach, the Trident, and the Vale. Though they would never again assemble in large numbers to face the king in open battle, the stars fought on in smaller ways, falling upon travellers and swarming over towns, villages, and poorly defended castles, slaying the king's loyalists wherever they found them. Sir Horace Hill had escaped the battle at Great Fork, but defeat and flight had tarnished him, and his followers were few. The new leaders of the poor fellows were men like Ragged Silas, Septon Moon, and Dennis the Lame, hardly distinguishable from outlaws. One of their most savage captains was a woman called Poxy Jane Poor, whose savage followers made the woods between King's Landing and Storm's End all but impassable to honest travellers. Meanwhile, the warrior's sons had chosen a new grand captain in the person of Sir Geoffrey Doggett, the Red Dog of the Hills, who was determined to restore the order to its former glory. When Sir Geoffrey set out from Lannisport to seek the blessing of the High Septon, 100 men rode with him. By the time he arrived in Oldtown, so many knights and squires and free riders had joined him that his numbers had swollen to 2,000. Elsewhere in the realm, other restless lords and men of faith were gathering men as well, and plotting ways to bring the dragons down. None of this had gone unnoticed. Ravens flew to every corner of the realm, summoning lords and landed knights of doubtful loyalty to King's Landing, to bend the knee, swear homage, and deliver a son or daughter as a hostage for their obedience. The stars and swords were outlawed. Membership in either order would henceforth be punishable by death. The High Septon was commanded to deliver himself to the Red Keep to stand trial for high treason. His High Holiness responded from the Starry Sept, commanding the king to present himself in Oldtown, to beg the forgiveness of the gods for his sins and cruelties. Many of the faithful echoed his defiance. Some pious lords did travel to King's Landing to do homage and present hostages, but more did not, trusting to their numbers and the strength of their castles to keep them safe. King Migor let the poisons fester for almost half a year, so engrossed was he in the building of his Red Keep. It was his mother who struck first. The Dowager Queen mounted Vhagar and brought fire and blood to the Reach, as once she had to Dawn. In a single night, the seats of House Blaintree, House Terrick, House Deddings, House Leicester, and House Wayne were set aflame. Then Migor himself took wing, flying Beleriand to the Westerlands, where he burned the castles of the Brooms, the Falwells, the Lorches, the Myats, and the other pious lords who had defied his royal summons. Lastly, he descended upon the seat of House Dogged, reducing the hall and stables to ash. The fires claimed the lives of Sir Geoffrey's father, mother, and young sister, along with their sworn swords, serving men, and chattel. As pillars of smoke rose all through the Westerlands and the Reach, Vhagar and Beleriand turned south. Another Lord Hightower, counseled by another High Septon, had opened the gates of Oldtown during the conquest. But now it seemed as if the greatest and most populous city in Westeros must surely burn. Thousands fled the city that night, streaming from the gates or taking ship for distant ports. Thousands more took to the streets in drunken revelry.
"This is a night for song and sin and drink," men told one another. "For come the morrow, the virtuous and the vile alike shall burn together."
Others gathered in septs and temples and ancient woods to pray they might be spared. In the Starry Sept, the High Septon railed and thundered, calling down the wrath of the gods upon the Targaryens. The Archmaesters of the Citadel met in conclave. The men of the city watch filled sacks with sand and pails with water to fight the fires they knew were coming. Along the city walls, crossbows, scorpions, spitfires, and spear throwers were hoisted onto the battlements in hopes of bringing down the dragons when they appeared. Led by Sir Morgan Hightower, a younger brother of the Lord of Oldtown, 200 warriors' sons spilled forth from their chapter house to defend His High Holiness, surrounding the Starry Sept with a ring of steel. Atop the Hightower, the great beacon fire turned a baleful green as Lord Martin Hightower called his banners. Oldtown waited for the dawn and the coming of the dragons. And the dragons came. Vhagar first, as the sun was rising, then Beleriand, just before midday. But they found the gates of the city open, the battlements unmanned, and the banners of House Targaryen, House Tyrell, and House Hightower flying side by side atop the city walls. The Dowager Queen Visenya was the first to learn the news. Sometime during the blackest hour of that long and dreadful night, the High Septon had died. A man of 53, as tireless as he was fearless, and to all appearances in robust good health, this High Septon had been renowned for his strength. More than once he had preached for a day and a night without taking sleep or nourishment. His sudden death shocked the city and dismayed his followers. Its causes are debated to this day. Some say that His High Holiness took his own life in what was either the act of a craven afraid to face the wrath of King Migor, or a noble sacrifice to spare the good folk of Oldtown from dragonfire. Others claim the Seven struck him down for the sin of pride, for heresy, treason, and arrogance. Many and more remain certain he was murdered. But by whom? Sir Morgan Hightower did the deed at the command of his lord brother, some say. And Sir Morgan was seen entering and leaving the High Septon's privy chambers that night. Others point to the Lady Patrice Hightower, Lord Martin's maiden aunt, and a reputed witch, who did indeed seek an audience with His High Holiness at dusk, though he was alive when she departed. The Archmaesters of the Citadel are also suspected, though whether they made use of the dark arts, an assassin, or a poisoned scroll, is still a matter of some debate. Messages went back and forth between the Citadel and the Starry Sept all night. And there are still others who hold them all blameless and lay the High Septon's death at the door of another rumored sorceress, the Dowager Queen, Visenya Targaryen. The truth will likely never be known. But the swift reaction of Lord Martin when word reached him at the High Tower is beyond dispute. At once he dispatched his own knights to disarm and arrest the warrior's sons, amongst them his own brother. The city gates were opened, and Targaryen banners raised along the walls. Even before Vhagar's wings were sighted, Lord Hightower's men were rousting the most devout from their beds and marching them to the Starry Sept at Spearpoint to choose a new High Septon. It required but a single ballot. Almost as one, the wise men and women of the faith turned to a certain Septon Peter. 90 years old, blind, stooped, and feeble, but famously amiable, the new High Septon almost collapsed beneath the weight of the crystal crown when it was placed upon his head. But when Migor Targaryen appeared before him in the Starry Sept, he was only too pleased to bless him as king and anoint his head with holy oils, even if he did forget the words of the blessing. Queen Visenya soon returned to Dragonstone with Vhagar, but King Migor remained in Oldtown for almost half the year, holding court and presiding over trials. To the captive swords of the warrior's sons, a choice was given. Those who renounced their allegiance to the Order would be permitted to travel to the Wall and live out their days as brothers of the Night's Watch. Those who refused could die as martyrs to their faith. Three-quarters of the captives chose to take the black. The remainder died. 7 of their number, famous knights and the sons of lords, were given the honor of having King Migor himself remove their heads with blackfire. The rest of the condemned were beheaded by their own former brothers in arms. Of all their number, only one man received a full royal pardon, Sir Morgan Hightower. The new High Septon formally dissolved both the warrior's sons and the poor fellows, commanding their remaining members to lay down their arms in the name of the gods. The Seven had no more need of warriors, proclaimed His High Holiness. Henceforth, the Iron Throne would protect and defend the faith. King Migor granted the surviving members of the faith militant till year's end to surrender their weapons and give up their rebellious ways. After that, those who remained defiant would find a bounty on their heads. A gold dragon for the head of any unrepentant warrior's son, a silver stag for the lice-ridden scalp of a poor fellow. The new High Septon did not demur, nor did the most devout. During his time at Oldtown, The king was also reconciled with his first wife, Queen Cerise, the sister of his host, Lord Hightower. Her grace agreed to accept the king's other wives, to treat them with respect and honor, and speak no further ill against them. Whilst Migor swore to restore Cerise to all the rights, incomes, and privileges due her as his wedded wife and queen. A great feast was held at the Hightower to celebrate their reconciliation. The revels even included a bedding and a second consummation, so all men would know this to be a true and loving union. How long King Migor might have lingered at Oldtown cannot be known, for in the latter part of 43 AC, word of another challenge to his throne reached his ears. His nephew Aegon, Prince of Dragonstone, had emerged from the west at last to stake his claim to the Iron Throne. Mounted on his own dragon Quicksilver, the eldest son of the late King Aenys had denounced his uncle as a tyrant and usurper, and was marching across the riverlands at the head of an army 15,000 strong. His followers were largely westermen and river lords. The lords Tarbeck, Piper, Root, Vance, Charlton, Frey, Page, Perrin, and Westerling were amongst them, joined by Lord Corbury of the Vale, the bastard of Bereton, and the fourth son of the Lord of Griffin's Roost. Though their ranks included seasoned commanders and puissant knights, no great lords had rallied to Prince Aegon's cause. But Queen Tyana, Mistress of Whisperers, wrote to warn Migor that Storm's End, the Eyrie, Winterfell, and Casterly Rock had all been in secret communication with the widowed Queen Alyssa. Before declaring for the Prince of Dragonstone, they wished to be convinced he might prevail. Aegon required a victory. Migor denied him that. From Harrenhal came forth Lord Harroway, from Riverrun Lord Tully. Sir Davos Darklyn of the Kingsguard marshalled 5,000 swords in King's Landing and struck out west to meet the rebels. Up from the Reach came Lord Rowan, Lord Merryweather, Lord Caswell and their levies. Prince Aegon's slow-moving host found armies closing from all sides, each smaller than their own force, but so many that the young prince, still but 17, did not know where to turn. Lord Corbray advised him to engage each foe separately before they could join their powers, but Aegon was loath to divide his strength. Instead, he chose to march on toward King's Landing. Just south of the God's Eye, he found Davos Darklyn's Kingslanders athwart his path, sitting on high ground behind a wall of spears, even as scouts reported Lords Merryweather and Caswell advancing from the south, and Lords Tully and Harroway from the north. Prince Aegon ordered a charge, hoping to break through the Kingslanders before the other loyalists fell upon his flanks, and mounted Quicksilver to lead the attack himself. But scarce had he taken wing when he heard shouts and saw his men below pointing to where Beleriand the Black Dread had appeared in the southern sky. King Migor had come. For the first time since the doom of Illyria, dragon contended with dragon in the sky, even as battle was joined below. Quicksilver, a quarter the size of Beleriand, was no match for the older, fiercer dragon, and her pale white fireballs were engulfed and washed away in great gouts of black flame. Then the Black Dread fell upon her from above, his jaws closing round her neck as he ripped one wing from her body. Screaming and smoking, the young dragon plunged to earth, and Prince Aegon with her. The battle below was nigh as brief, if bloodier. Once Aegon fell, the rebels saw their cause was doomed and ran, discarding arms and armor as they fled. But the loyalist armies were all around them, and there was no escape. By day's end, 2,000 of Aegon's men had died, against 100 of the king's. Amongst the dead were Lord Alan Tarbeck, Dennis Snow, the bastard of Bereton, Lord John Piper, Lord Ronald Vance, Sir Willem Whistler, and Aegon Targaryen, Prince of Dragonstone. The only notable loss amongst the loyalists was Sir Davos Darklyn of the King's Guard, slain by Lord Corbury with Lady Forlorn. Half a year of trials and executions followed. Queen Visenya persuaded her son to spare some of the rebellious lords. But even those who kept their lives lost lands and titles and were forced to give up hostages. The 44th year after the conquest was a peaceful one, compared to what had gone before. But the maesters who chronicled those times wrote that the smell of blood and fire still hung heavy in the air. Maegor the First Targaryen sat the Iron Throne as his Red Keep rose around him, but his court was grim and cheerless, despite the presence of three queens. Or perhaps because of it. Each night he summoned one of his wives to his bed, yet still he remained childless, with no heir but for the sons and grandsons of his brother Aenys. Maegor the Cruel, he was called, and Kinslayer as well, though it was death to say either in his hearing. In Old Town, the ancient High Septon died, and another was raised up in his place. Though he spoke no word against the king or his queens, the enmity between King Maegor and the Faith endured. Hundreds of poor fellows had been hunted down and slain, their scalps delivered to the king's men for the bounty. But thousands more still roamed the woods and hedges and the wild places of the Seven Kingdoms, cursing the Targaryens with their every breath. One band even crowned their own High Septon in the person of a bearded brute named Septon Moon. And a few warrior sons still endured, led by Sir Joffrey Doggett, the Red Dog of the Hills. Outlawed and condemned, the Order no longer had the strength to meet the king's men in open battle, so the Red Dog sent them out in the guise of hedge knights to hunt and slay Targaryen loyalists and traitors to the faith. Their first victim was Sir Morgan Hightower, late of their order, cut down and butchered on the road to Honeyholt. Old Lord Merryweather was the next to die, followed by Lord Rowan's son and heir, Davos Darklyn's aged father, even blind John Hogg. Though the bounty for the head of a warrior's son was a golden dragon, the small folk and peasants of the realm hid and protected them, remembering what they had been. On Dragonstone, the Dowager Queen Visenya had grown thin and haggard, the flesh melting from her bones. Her nephew's widow, the former Queen Alyssa, remained on the island as well, with her son Jaehaerys and her daughter Alysanne. Maegor had made them his mother's wards, prisoners in all but name. But Prince Viserys, the eldest surviving son of Aenys and Alyssa, was summoned to court by Maegor. A promising lad of 15 years, skilled with sword and lance, Viserys was made squire to the king, with a Kingsguard knight for a shadow, to keep him away from plots and treasons. For a brief while in 44 AC, it seemed as if the king might soon have that son he desired so desperately. Queen Alice announced she was with child, and the court rejoiced. Grand Maester Desmond confined her grace to her bed as she grew great with child, and took charge of her care, assisted by two septers, a midwife, and the queen's sisters Jane and Hannah. Maegor insisted that his other wives serve his pregnant queen as well. During the third moon of her confinement, however, Lady Alice began to bleed heavily from the womb, and lost the child. When King Maegor came to see the stillbirth, he was horrified to find the boy a monster, with twisted limbs, a huge head, and no eyes.
"This cannot be my son!" he roared in anguish.
Then his grief turned to fury, and he ordered the immediate execution of the midwife and septers who had charge of the queen's care, and Grand Maester Desmond as well, sparing only Alice's sisters. It is said that Maegor was seated on the Iron Throne with the head of the Grand Maester in his hands when Queen Tyana came to tell him he had been deceived. The child was not his seed. Seeing Queen Cerise return to court, old and bitter and childless, Alice Haraway had begun to fear that the same fate awaited her, unless she gave the king a son. So she had turned to her lord father, the hand of the king. On the nights when the king was sharing a bed with Queen Cerise or Queen Tyana, Lucas Haraway sent men to his daughter's bed to get her with child. Migor refused to believe. He told Tyana she was a jealous witch and barren, throwing the Grand Maester's head at her.
Spiders do not lie,
the mistress of the Whisperers replied. She handed the king a list of names. Written there were the names of 20 men alleged to have given their seed to Queen Alice. Old men and young, handsome men and homely ones, knights and squires, lords and servants, even grooms and smiths and singers. The king's hand had cast a wide net, it seemed. The men had only one thing in common. All were men of proven potency, known to have fathered healthy children. Under torture, all but two confessed. One, a father of 12, still had the gold paid him by Lord Haraway for his services. The questioning was carried out swiftly and secretly, so Lord Haraway and Queen Alice had no inkling of the king's suspicions until the king's guard burst in on them. Dragged from her bed, Queen Alice saw her sisters killed before her eyes as they tried to protect her. Her father, inspecting the Tower of the Hand, was flung from its roof to smash upon the stones below. Haraway's sons, brothers, and nephews were taken as well. Thrown onto the spikes that lined the dry moat around Migor's holdfast, some took hours to die. The simple-minded Horace Haraway was said to linger for days. The 20 names on Queen Tyana's list soon joined them, and then another dozen men, named by the first 20. The worst death was reserved for Queen Alice herself, who was given over to her sister wife Tyana for torment. Of her death we will not speak, for some things are best buried and forgotten. Suffice it to say that her dying took the best part of a fortnight, and that Migor himself was present for all of it, a witness to her agony. After her death, the queen's body was cut into 7 parts, and her pieces mounted on spikes above the 7 gates of the city, where they remained until they rotted. King Migor himself departed King's Landing, assembling a strong force of knights and men-at-arms, and marching on Harrenhal, to complete the destruction of House Haraway. The great castle on the God's Eye was lightly held, and its castellan, a nephew of Lord Lucas and cousin to the late queen, opened his gates at the king's approach. Surrender did not save him. His grace put the entire garrison to the sword, along with every man, woman, and child he found to have any drop of Haraway blood. Then he marched to Lord Haraway's town on the Trident, and did the same there. In the aftermath of the bloodletting, men began to say that Harrenhal was cursed, for every lordly house to hold it had come to a bad and bloody end. Nonetheless, many ambitious king's men coveted Black Heron's mighty seat, with its broad and fertile lands. So many that King Migor grew weary of their entreaties and decreed that Harrenhal should go to the strongest of them. Thus did 23 knights of the king's household fight with sword and mace and lance amidst the blood-soaked streets of Lord Haraway's town. Sir Walton Towers emerged victorious, and Migor named him Lord of Harrenhal. But the melee had been a savage affray, and Sir Walton did not live long to enjoy his lordship, dying of his wounds within the fortnight. Harrenhal passed to his eldest son, though its domains were much diminished, as the king granted Lord Haraway's town to Lord Alton Butterwell, and the rest of the Haraway holdings to Lord Dormond Darry. When, at last, Migor returned to King's Landing to seat himself again upon the Iron Throne, he was greeted with the news that his mother, Queen Visenya, had died. Moreover, in the confusion that followed the death of the Queen Dowager, Queen Alyssa and her children found their way to a ship and made their escape from Dragonstone. To where, no man could say. They had even gone so far as to steal Dark Sister from Visenya's chambers as they fled. His Grace ordered his mother's body burned, her bones and ashes interred beside those of her brother and sister. Then he told his knights to seize his squire, Prince Viserys.
Chain him in a black cell and question him sharply,
Migor commanded.
Ask him where his mother has gone.
He may not know, said Sir Owen Bush, a knight of Migor's Kingsguard.
Then let him die,
the king answered famously.
Perhaps the bitch will turn up for his funeral.
Prince Viserys did not know where his mother had gone, not even when Tyana of Pentos plied him with her dark arts. After 9 days of questioning, he died. His body was left out in the ward of the Red Keep for a fortnight at the king's command.
Let his mother come and claim him,
Migor said. But Queen Alyssa never appeared, and at last his grace consigned his nephew to the fire. The prince was 16 years old when he was killed, and had been much loved by small folk and lords alike. The realm wept for him. In 45 AC, construction finally came to an end on the Red Keep. King Migor celebrated its completion by feasting the builders and workmen who had labored on the castle, sending them wagon loads of strong wine and sweetmeats, and whores from the city's finest brothels. The revels lasted for 3 days. Afterward, the king's knights moved in and put all the workmen to the sword to prevent them from ever revealing the Red Keep's secrets. Their bones were interred beneath the castle that they had built. Not long after the completion of the castle, Queen Cerise was stricken with a sudden illness and passed away. A rumor went around the court that Her Grace had given offense to the king with a shrewish remark, so he had commanded Sir Owen to remove her tongue. As the tale went, the queen had struggled, Sir Owen's knife had slipped, and the queen's throat had been slit. Though never proven, this story was widely believed at the time. Today, however, most maesters believe it to be a slander concocted by the king's enemies to further blacken his repute. Whatever the truth, the death of his first wife left Migor with but a single queen, the black-haired, black-hearted Pentoshi woman, Tyana, mistress of the spiders, who was hated and feared by all. Hardly had the last stone been set on the Red Keep than Migor commanded that the ruins of the Sept of Remembrance be cleared from the top of Rhaenys' Hill, and with them the bones and ashes of the warrior's sons who had perished there. In their place, he decreed, a great stone stable for dragons would be erected, a lair worthy of Beleriand, Vhagar, and their Geat. Thus commenced the building of the Dragon Pit. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it proved difficult to find builders, stonemasons and laborers to work on the project. So many men ran off that the king was finally forced to use prisoners from the city's dungeons as his workforce, under the supervision of builders brought in from Myre and Volantis. Late in the year 45 AC, King Migor took the field once again to continue his war against the outlawed remnants of the Faith Militant, leaving Queen Tyana to rule King's Landing together with the new hand, Lord Edwell Celtigar. In the great woods south of the Blackwater, the king's forces hunted down scores of poor fellows who had taken refuge there, sending many to the wall, and hanging those who refused to take the black. Their leader, the woman known as Poxy Jane Poor, continued to elude the king until at last she was betrayed by 3 of her own followers, who received pardons and knighthoods as their reward. 3 septons, travelling with his grace, declared Poxy Jane a witch, and Migor ordered her to be burned alive in a field beside the Wendwater. When the day appointed for her execution came, 300 of her followers, poor fellows and peasants all, burst from the woods to rescue her. The king had anticipated this, however, and his men were ready for the attack. The rescuers were surrounded and slaughtered. Amongst the last to die was their leader, who proved to be Sir Horace Hill, the bastard hedge knight who had escaped the carnage at the Great Fork 3 years earlier. This time, he proved less fortunate. Elsewhere in the realm, however, the tide of the times had begun to turn against the king. Small folk and lords alike had come to despise him for his many cruelties, and many began to give help and comfort to his enemies. Septon Moon, the High Septon raised up by the poor fellows against the man in Oldtown they called the High Lickspittal, roamed the riverlands and reach at will, drawing huge crowds whenever he emerged from the woods to preach against the king. The hill country north of the Golden Tooth was ruled in all but name by the Red Dog, Sir Geoffrey Doggett, and neither Casterly Rock nor River Run seemed inclined to move against him. Dennis the Lame and Ragged Silas remained at large, and wherever they roamed, small folk helped keep them safe. Knights and men-at-arms, sent out to bring them to justice, oft vanished. In 46 AC, King Migor returned to the Red Keep with 2,000 skulls, the fruits of a year of campaigning. They were the heads of poor fellows and warriors' sons, he announced, as he dumped them out beneath the Iron Throne. But it was widely believed that many of the grisly trophies belonged to simple crofters, field hands, and swineherds, guilty of no crime but faith. The coming of the new year found Migor still without a son, not even a bastard who might be legitimized. Nor did it seem likely that Queen Tyana would give him the heir that he desired. While she continued to serve his grace as Mistress of Whisperers, the king no longer sought her bed. It was past time for him to take a new wife, Migor's counselors agreed, but they parted ways on who that wife should be. Grandmaster Benifer suggested a match with the proud and lovely lady of Starfall, Clarice Dane, in the hopes of detaching her lands and house from Dawn. Alton Butterwell, Master of Coin, offered his widowed sister, a stout woman with 7 children. Though admittedly no beauty, he argued, her fertility had been proved beyond a doubt. The king's hand, Lord Celtigar, had 2 young maiden daughters, 13 and 12 years of age, respectively. He urged the king to take his pick of them, or marry both if he preferred. Lord Valerian of Driftmark advised Migor to send for his niece, Princess Rhaenar, his brother's daughter, and the widow of his brother's son, and take her to wife. By wedding Rhaenar, the king would unite their claims and strengthen the royal bloodline. King Migor listened to each man in turn. Though in the end he scorned most of the women they put forward, some of their reasons and arguments took root in him. He would have a woman of proven fertility, he decided, though not Butterwell's fat and homely sister. He would take more than one wife, as Lord Celtigar urged. 2 wives would double his chances of getting a son. 3 wives would triple it. And one of those wives should surely be his niece. There was wisdom in Lord Valerian's counsel. Queen Alyssa and her 2 youngest children remained in hiding. It was thought that they had fled across the narrow sea to Tyroche or perhaps Volantis. But they still represented a threat to Migor's crown and any son he might father. Taking Aenys' daughter to wife would weaken any claims put forward by her younger siblings. After the death of her husband in the battle beneath the God's Eye, Rhaenar Targaryen had acted quickly to protect her daughters. If Prince Aegon had truly been the king, then, by law, his eldest daughter Arya stood his heir, and might therefore claim to be the rightful queen of the 7 kingdoms. But Arya and her sister Rhaella were barely a year old, and Rhaenar knew that to trumpet such claims would be tantamount to condemning them to death. Instead, She dyed their hair, changed their names, and sent them from her, entrusting them to certain powerful allies who would see them fostered in good homes by worthy men who would have no inkling of their true identity. Even their mother must not know where the girls were going, the princess insisted. What she did not know, she could not reveal, even under torture. No such escape was possible for Aenar Targaryen herself. Though she could change her name, dye her hair, and garb herself in a tavern wench's rough spun or the robes of a scepter, there was no disguising her dragon. Dreamfire was a slender, pale blue she-dragon with silvery markings who had already produced 2 clutches of eggs, and Rhaenar had been riding her since the age of 12. Dragons are not easily hidden. Instead, the princess saddled her and took them both as far from Meagor as she could, to Fair Isle, where Lord Farman granted her the hospitality of Fair Castle, with its tall white towers rising high above the sunset sea. And there she rested, reading, praying, wondering how long she would be given, before her uncle sent for her. Rhaenar never doubted that he would, she said afterward. It was a question of when, not if. The summons came sooner than she would have liked, though not as soon as she might have feared. There was no question of defiance. That would only bring the king down on Fair Isle with Beleriand. Rhaenar had grown fond of Lord Farman, and more than fond of his second son, Andro. She would not repay their kindness with fire and blood. She mounted Dreamfire and flew to the Red Keep, where she learned that she must marry her uncle, her husband's killer. And there as well, Rhaenar met her fellow brides, for this was to be a triple wedding. All 3 of the new queens-to-be were widows. Lady Jane of House Westerling had been married to Lord Alan Tarbeck, who had marched beside Prince Aegon, and died with him in the battle beneath the god's eye. A few months later, she had given her late lord a posthumous son. Tall and slender, with lustrous brown hair, Lady Jane was being courted by a younger son of the Lord of Casterly Rock when Meagor sent for her. But this meant little, and less to the king. More troubling was the case of Lady Eleanor of House Castaigne, the fiery red-haired wife of Sir Theo Bolling, a landed knight who had fought for the king in his last campaign against the Poor Fellows. Though only 19, Lady Eleanor had already given Bolling 3 sons when the king's eye fell upon her. The youngest boy was still at her breast when their father, Sir Theo, was arrested by 2 knights of the king's guard and charged with conspiring with Queen Alyssa to murder the king and place the boy Jaehaerys on the Iron Throne. Though Bolling protested his innocence, he was found guilty and beheaded the same day. King Meagor gave his widow 7 days to mourn in honor of the gods, then summoned her to tell her they would marry. At the town of Stony Sept, Sept and Moon appeared to denounce King Meagor's wedding plans, and hundreds of townfolk cheered wildly. But few others dared to raise their voices against his grace. The High Septon took ship at Old Town, sailing to King's Landing to perform the marriage rites. On a warm spring day, in the 47th year after the conquest, Meagor Targaryen took 3 wives in the ward of the Red Keep. Though each of his new queens was garbed and cloaked in the colors of her father's house, the people of King's Landing called them the Black Brides, for all were widows. The presence of Lady Jane's son and Lady Eleanor's 3 boys at the wedding ensured that they would play their parts in the ceremony. But there were many who expected some show of defiance from Princess Rhaenar. Such hopes were quelled when Queen Tyana appeared, escorting 2 young girls with silver hair and purple eyes, clad in the red and black of House Targaryen.
"You were foolish to think you could hide them from me," Tyana told the princess.
Rhaenar bowed her head and spoke her vows, weeping. Many queer and contradictory stories are told of the night that followed. And with the passage of so many years, it is difficult to separate truth from legends. Did the three black brides share a single bed, as some claim? It seems unlikely. Did His Grace visit all three women during the night and consummate all three unions? Perhaps. Did Princess Reynard attempt to kill the king with a dagger concealed beneath her pillows, as she later claimed? Did Eleanor Castaigne scratch the king's back to bloody ribbons as they coupled? Did Jane Westerling drink the fertility potion that Queen Tyana supposedly brought her, or throw it in the older woman's face? Was such a potion ever mixed or offered? The first account of it does not appear until well into the reign of King Jaehaerys, 20 years after both women were dead. This we know. In the immediate aftermath of the wedding, King Migor declared Princess Rhaenyra's daughter, Arya, his lawful heir.
Until such time as the gods grant me a son,
while sending her twin sister Rhaella to Oldtown to be raised as a scepter. His nephew, Jaehaerys, felt by many to be the rightful heir, was expressly disinherited in the same decree. Queen Jane's son was confirmed as Lord of Tarbeck Hall and sent to Casterly Rock to be raised as a ward of House Lannister, and Queen Eleanor's elder boys were similarly disposed of, one to the Eyrie, one to Highgarden. The Queen's youngest babe was turned over to a wet nurse, as the King found the Queen's nursing irksome. Half a year after the wedding, Lord Celtigar, the King's hand, announced that Queen Jane was with child. Hardly had her belly begun to swell when the King himself revealed that Queen Eleanor was also pregnant. Migor showered both women with gifts and honours, and granted new lands and offices to their fathers, brothers, and uncles. But his joy proved to be short-lived. 3 moons before she was due, Queen Jane was brought to bed by a sudden onset of labour pains, and was delivered of a stillborn child as monstrous as the one Alice Haraway had birthed. A legless and armless creature, possessed of both male and female genitals. Nor did the mother long survive the child. Migor was cursed, men said. He had slain his nephew, made war against the faith and the High Septon, defied the gods, committed murder and incest, adultery and rape. His privy parts were poisoned, his seed full of worms. The gods would never grant him a living son. Or so the whispers ran. Migor himself settled on a different explanation, and sent Sir Owen Bush and Sir Maladon Moore to seize Queen Tyana and deliver her to the dungeons. There the Pentashe Queen made a full confession, even as the king's torturers readied their implements. She had poisoned Jane Westerling's child in the womb, just as she had Alice Haraway's. It would be the same with Eleanor Castaigne's whelp, she promised. It is said that the king slew her himself, cutting out her heart with blackfire and feeding it to his dogs. But even in death, Tyana of the Tower had her revenge, for it came to pass just as she had promised. The moon turned and turned again, and in the black of night, Queen Eleanor too was delivered of a malformed and stillborn child, an eyeless boy, born with rudimentary wings. That was in the 48th year after the conquest, the 6th year of King Migor's reign, and the last year of his life. No man in the Seven Kingdoms could doubt that the king was accursed now. What followers still remained to him began to melt away, evaporating like dew in the morning sun. Word reached King's Landing that Sir Geoffrey Doggett had been seen entering Riverrun, not as a captive, but as a guest of Lord Tully. Septon Moon appeared once more, leading thousands of the faithful on a march across the reach to Oldtown, with the announced intent of bearding the lickspittle in the Starry Sept to demand that he denounce
the abomination on the Iron Throne, and lift his ban on the military orders. When Lord Oakheart and Lord Rowan appeared before him with their levies, they came not to attack Moon, but to join him. Lord Celtigar resigned his king's hand and returned to his seat on Claw Isle. Reports from the Dornish marches suggested that the Dornishmen were gathering in the passes, preparing to invade the realm. The worst blow came from Storm's End. There on the shores of Shipbreaker Bay, Lord Rhaegar Baratheon proclaimed young Jaehaerys Targaryen to be the true and lawful king of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and Prince Jaehaerys named Lord Rhaegar protector of the realm and hand of the king. The prince's mother, Queen Alyssa, and his sister Alysanne stood beside him as Jaehaerys unsheathed Darksister and vowed to end the reign of his usurping uncle. 100 banner lords and Stormland knights cheered the proclamation. Prince Jaehaerys was 14 years old when he claimed the throne. A handsome youth, skilled with lance and longbow, and a gifted rider. More, he rode a great bronze and tan beast called Vermithor, and his sister Alysanne, a maid of 12, commanded her own dragon, Silverwing.
Maegor has only one dragon, Lord Rhaegar told the Stormlords. Our prince has two.
And soon three. When word reached the Red Keep that Jaehaerys was gathering his forces at Storm's End, Rhaenar Targaryen mounted Dreamfire and flew to join him, abandoning the uncle she'd been forced to wed. She took her daughter Arya and Blackfyre, stolen from the king's own scabbard as he slept. King Maegor's response was sluggish and confused. He commanded the Grand Maester to send forth his ravens, summoning all his leal lords and bannermen to gather at King's Landing, only to find that Ben Iffa had taken ship for Pentos. Finding Princess Arya gone, he sent a rider to Old Town to demand the head of her twin sister, Rhaella, to punish their mother for her betrayal. But Lord Hightower imprisoned his messenger instead. Two of his Kingsguard vanished one night to go over to Jaehaerys, and Sir Owen Bush was found dead outside a brothel, his member stuffed into his mouth. Lord Velaryon of Driftmark was amongst the first to declare for Jaehaerys. As the Velaryons were the realm's traditional admirals, Maegor woke to find he had lost the entire royal fleet. The Tyrells of Highgarden followed, with all the power of the Reach. The Hightowers of Oldtown, the Redwynes of the Arbor, the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Aerons of the Eyrie, the Royces of Runestone. One by one, they came out against the king. In King's Landing, a score of lesser lords gathered at Maegor's command, amongst them Lord Darklyn of Duskendale, Lord Massey of Stonedance, Lord Towers of Harrenhal, Lord Staunton of Rook's Rest, Lord Bar Emmon of Sharppoint, Lord Buckwell of the Antlers, the Lords Rosby, Stokeworth, Hayford, Hart, Birch, Rollingford, Bywater, and Mallory. Yet they commanded scarce 4,000 men amongst them all, and only 1 in 10 of those were knights. Maegor brought them together in the Red Keep one night to discuss his plan of battle. When they saw how few they were, and realized that no great lords were coming to join them, many lost heart, and Lord Hayford went so far as to urge his grace to abdicate and take the black. His grace ordered Hayford beheaded on the spot, and continued the war council with his lordship's head mounted on a lance behind the Iron Throne. All day the lords made plans, and late into the night. It was the hour of the wolf when at last Maegor allowed them to take their leave. The king remained behind, brooding on the Iron Throne as they departed. Lord Towers and Lord Rosby were the last to see his grace. Hours later, as dawn was breaking, the last of Maegor's queens came seeking after him. Queen Eleanor found him still upon the Iron Throne, pale and dead, his robes soaked through with blood. His arms had been slashed open from wrist to elbow on jagged barbs,
and another blade had gone through his neck to emerge beneath his chin. Many to this day believe it was the Iron Throne itself that killed him. Migor was alive when Rosby and Towers left the throne room, they argue, and the guards at the door swore that no one entered afterward, until Queen Eleanor made her discovery. Some say it was the Queen herself who forced him down onto those barbs and blades to avenge the murder of her first husband. The King's Guard might have done the deed, though that would have required them to act in concert, as there were two knights posted at each door. It might also have been a person or persons unknown, entering and leaving the throne room through some secret passage. The Red Keep has its secrets, known only to the dead. It may also be that the King tasted despair in the dark watches of the night and took his own life, twisting the blades as needed and opening his veins to spare himself the defeat and disgrace that surely awaited him. The reign of King Migor the First Targaryen, known to history and legend as Migor the Cruel, lasted 6 years and 66 days. Upon his death, his corpse was burned in the yard of the Red Keep, his ashes interred afterward on Dragonstone beside those of his mother. He died childless and left no heir of his body. 9 days later, three dragons were seen in the sky over King's Landing. Princess Rhaenar had returned, and with her came her brother, Jaehaerys, and her sister, Alysanne. Their mother, the Dowager Queen Alyssa, arrived a fortnight later, riding beside the Lord of Storm's End at the head of a great host, their banners streaming. The small folk cheered. Ravens were sent forth to every castle in the realm, inviting all lords, great and small, to come to King's Landing to bear witness at the coronation of a new king, a true king. And they came. In the 48th year after the conquest, before the eyes of gods and men and half the lords of Westeros, the High Septon of Oldtown placed his father's golden crown upon the brow of the young prince and proclaimed him Jaehaerys of House Targaryen, the first of his name, King of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. His mother Alyssa would act as his regent during the remaining years of the king's minority, whilst Lord Rhaegar Baratheon was named Protector of the Realm and Hand of the King. Half a year later, the two of them would wed. 14 years old at his ascent, Jaehaerys would sit the Iron Throne for 55 years, and in due course become known as the Old King and the Conciliator. But that is a tale best told at another time, by another maester.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Book of Swords, edited by Gardner Dozois. This program was directed by Richard Brewer, with The Mocking Tower directed by Lisa Watstein. Executive producers Linda Korn and Dan Musselman. Associate producer Amber Beard. Copyright 2017 by Gardner Dozois. Introduction copyright 2017 by Gardner Dozois. Read by Arthur Morey. The Best Man Wins by K.J. Parker. Copyright 2017 by Tom Holt, K.J. Parker. Read by John Lee. Her Father's Sword by Robin Hobb. Copyright 2017 by Robin Hobb, Megan Lindholm. Read by Catherine McEwen. The Hidden Girl by Ken Liu. Copyright 2017 by Ken Liu. Read by Kim Mai Guest. The Sword of Destiny by Matthew Hughes. Copyright 2017 by Matthew Hughes. Read by Elliot Hill. I Am a Handsome Man, Said Apollo Crow by Kate Elliott. Copyright 2017 by Alice Rasmussen, Kate Elliott. Read by Steve West. The Triumph of Virtue by Walter John Williams. Copyright 2017 by Walter John Williams. Read by Elliot Hill. The Mocking Tower by Daniel Abraham. Copyright 2017 by Daniel Abraham. Read by Richard Brewer. Hunting by C.J. Cherry. Copyright 2017 by C.J. Cherry. Read by John Lee. A Long, Cold Trail by Garth Nix. Copyright 2017 by Garth Nix. Read by Nicholas Guy Smith. When I Was a Highwayman by Ellen Kushner. Copyright 2017 by Ellen Kushner. Read by Kirby Hayborn. The Smoke of Gold is Glory by Scott Lynch. Copyright 2017 by Scott Lynch. Read by Ralph Lister. The Colgrid Conundrum by Rich Larson. Copyright 2017 by Rich Larson. Read by Mark Deakins. The King's Evil by Elizabeth Baer. Copyright 2017 by Sarah Wisniewski, Elizabeth Baer. Read by Julia Whalen. Waterfalling by Lavi Tidhar. Copyright 2017 by Lavi Tidhar. Read by Mark Deakins. The Sword Tireste by Cecilia Holland. Copyright 2017 by Cecilia Holland. Read by Steve West. The Sons of the Dragon by George R. R. Martin. Copyright 2017 by George R. R. Martin. Read by Ralph Lister. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.